Okay. Yeah, I'm starting.
We were recording.
No, I thought, well, usually I do, but I wasn't sure if you wanted to just get straight into it. But happy International Women's Day.
Yeah, that's a big surprise.
We're doing a celebration of, just like you said, we're doing a celebration of some of the baddest bitches on the planet, both past and present.
Yeah, it's a bad bitches have a long history in the world. And I think through some of the stuff that we just looked at, like trying to choose topics, they definitely, there's a shine to them. But the shine that they get isn't always as big and as great as it seems like some of the other...
I mean, you have your, you know, top tier ones that people, you know, Cleopatra that bad everybody bitch. Knows about.
Marie Curie, a scientific woman.
Madam.
Madam. I guess. Well, that was, what is that what's that title for?
Is that, well, Madam, like, you, Madam, now when you think of Madam, you think of like fucking like Heidi Fleiss and shit. So I think that was kind of a hijacked term. But back before, Madam used to essentially mean like...
Madams ran whorehouses.
Yeah, but at the same time, I also... Didn't they use that for like if you were in like a prep school and stuff like that? Or if like a like academy...
Oh, like a teacher?
A Madam, something like that.
Or if you... Is it like... No, because that's Dame, right?
Dame There's is basically
knight
the...
and then Dame?
Sir.
So like Sir
it's
Elton
the
John,
it's the Dame female Judy version Dench. Of... Exactly. It's the female version of Sir in England. However they... Do they get knighted the same way, like with the sword on the shoulder?
I mean, we still have a family that runs an entire country through a puppet. Yeah. Why would they
ceremonial
change that?
Family. There's no... It's still just... It's thing. Wealth. It's not power in that situation. It's a... You know, it's a ceremonial type shit, but...
I don't see why they take out the sword part. That's the coolest part of the ceremonial family.
Yes, it is. Like tapping that sword on your shoulder. All right, so, yeah.
Hoping that sword's not too heavy for Elizabeth or King George, whatever
or
the fuck he is now.
King Charles now.
He just drops it on your shoulder.
You're not shaking it too much. Like, that shit's so close to my... Do you mind if I wear, like, a turtleneck or something while he's doing this? Maybe some earmuffs just to make sure that if he has, like, an involuntary twitch, I'm not losing losing something I need.
If this dude sneezes, I might die.
Jesus Christ. You just see him up there going... You're like, pause the knighting ceremony.
Tomorrow.
Get that out.
Can we do this over Zoom?
There's too much fucking dust in this room for me to be knighted today. Oh, all right. You want to kick it off first? We'll just go back and forth.
Yeah. I'll knock it out. This one, I looking into it, I feel like sports is kind of a natural barrier to entry for really anything. And I know that there's a lot of fantastic women out there, but I just went sports-wise because I found this first one extremely interesting, and that is the women of the A... This is how you know it was a women's organization. This is called the AAGPBL.
The AGPBL.
The All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. That's a fucking mouthful.
Most people are going to know this if you're looking for something to identify it with. League of Their Own.
Yep. And they have, I think there's, actually I didn't watch it, but they have a Amazon series of it now too.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're trying to revive it, and that basically is the story of the AAGPBL, sort of, in a way.
Do you just want to refer to it as something else?
Yeah, just
Women's Professional Baseball League.
Mm-hmm. Because they actually did have like a budding rivalry with another one that was called the NGBL, National Girls Baseball League.
All right.
I don't know why it has to be girls. Like, why can't we just do women?
Yeah.
But at the same time, the bad part about a league of their own is it kind of leaves off towards the end, like it only happened for 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
This whole league was around for 11 years. These women played for 11 seasons and did fairly well. I mean, the founder, Philip Wrigley, the gum guy, big fixture in Chicago. He was a gum magnate and an owner.
Representing Cubs.
Huh?
Representing Cubs.
Did he own the Cubs for a long time?
Do you think it was something where he was just the sponsor of the field, but it was so long like that, like they're not going to change it change the name. I assume I'm going to go, you know, at some point we'll probably dig deeper into this, but I'm going to assume that he was the original founder. If he founded this league, then I'm sure he was involved in professional baseball because he had a foundation in it.
Well, and he just had all the money. He had a god's worth of money being a Wrigley. So he could have probably done whatever he wanted. But he actually was the first. He was the founder. It got taken over by another guy who is kind of like
I just see someone from like Texas O&M be like, "Oh, women's league."
Well,
I say.
They did the whole thing in the Midwest. That was kind of the idea.
Mm-hmm.
And as it was founded, the reason that it was founded was because they were worried that as the talent pool was to start spilling over into the war.
And yeah, as guys got drafted or chose to go drafting
able-bodied athletic gentlemen.
Who was it? Was it, who's the big one from
Ted Williams?
No, there was someone else from the Yankees that went and fought too. The guy that hooked up with Marilyn Monroe.
Oh,
how are we drawing a blank on this?
Not Roger Maris. Played with Roger Maris.
He's literally like Mr. Yankee or some shit.
There's so many Mr. Yankees. And we're not even going to get into the most important, well, the second most important babe. We'll get into the most important babe later because I think that this chick's incredible. But the whole reason was they were worried about not having enough players to try to keep up attendance at the ballparks, because if they couldn't keep a decent amount of attendance up, they weren't going to be making any money. Therefore, why have the baseball league going at that point?
And at that point, if something has to close up shop for an extended period of time where they don't know how long this war is going to go on, there's a possibility that something doesn't come back.
Yeah, and that's the whole thing that they're worried about, is they wanted to keep attention and attendance going. The other thing that they were worried about was there was a gas shortage. They were rationing gas to
Joe DiMaggio.
Oh, yeah, Joe D.
Yeah.
They wanted to make sure that gas rationing wasn't as big of a deal as possible, because you can't ship an entire team across the country when you're in a war and you're trying to send all your fuel sources to a war. So when they created this league, there were 15 teams that had kind of come into existence and gone into existence. Really, it was just about 10 that played. Over 600 women played, which that's, I mean, over 11 years, that's a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the names, it's, the whole thing is a little bit sexist because obviously men named all these. But
Was the Rockford Peaches one of them?
Yep.
Okay.
They had the Kenosha Comets, the Racine Belles, Rockford Peaches, like you mentioned, South Bend Blue Sox, don't want to know where that came from, the Milwaukee Chicks, the Minneapolis Millerettes, the Fort Wayne Daisies, the Grand Rapids Chicks, put a lot of thought into mm-hmm. that one, the Muskegon Lassies, the Peoria Red Wings, the Chicago Colleens, the Springfield Sallies, probably got made fun of a lot, the women. Kalamazoo Lassies. So we dipped into Lassies twice.
Not a lot
twice.
Of creativity here. They're just like, what are the words that we know that we call as a nickname toward women at this point?
Yeah, I think the Lassies moved because it was Muskegon Lassies from 46 to 49 and then the Kalamazoo Lassies from 50 to 54. The Battle Creek Belles and the Muskegon Belles, so I'm assuming that was probably around the same thing. But to go on for 11 years, and during that 11 years, it was the, I believe it was the Rockford Peaches. They ended up winning 4 titles. And the amount of games that they played was just
They had Incredible. Gina Davis playing catcher. I mean,
yeah,
she was an all-star. They had Rosie O'Donnell out there. Who else did they have?
Tom
Madonna.
Hanks was coaching.
Madonna was out. Yeah.
Yeah, dude. They just had a full-on, it was a great cast to play it. And these women just, as far as sports goes, there's a certain thing that you see. Like when you hear people talk about, oh, the WNBA isn't as great as the NBA, anything like that. When you listen to an athlete talk about playing a sport, you can always tell that there's just a common thread, male, female, mm-hmm. just really anything.
Well, the thing is about that too, and I want to get to this 600 women played. Where are the comments coming from about the WNBA? From people that these WNBA players could wipe the fucking floor with them on a basketball court.
I would defy any guy that played high school basketball to go out and try to beat one of these women in one-on-one.
And then you look at the NBA players and people that are either playing college ball, whatnot, and their comments toward the WNBA, it's nothing but respect.
Yeah, because they know. They
know the skill set that requires.
Well, and they understand. Anytime that you ever hear a human say, and I'm known for hyperbole, I think. You and I have had the orangutan debate many times. When you hear somebody say that they could go out and score on an NBA player, no, you can't.
No.
I don't care if you're a division, if you were a great high school basketball player, you're not getting a point up on these guys.
Not even from the guy on the end of the bench. The only way you're getting it is if he thinks you're going to drive and he leaves you and you're standing 5 feet beyond the arc and you just chuck one up. You're going to get a shot. If they're covering you and they're playing on you, you're never getting past them. You're never getting past the free throw line.
Even then, you have a 6'6 guy that's got a 30-foot jump.
30-inch vertical.
Yeah, 30-inch vertical.
30-foot, Jesus.
It said 30-inch.
You said 30-foot.
I think it said 30-foot jump. Or a 30-inch jump. I don't fucking know. Whatever. 30-inch vertical. You're not getting your hand, or you're not getting the ball up over his hand.
No.
And these women are the exact same way. When you run into like a Breanne Stewart or something like that that's playing now, that's 6'6", 6'7", and she can stick that big paw up, you're not getting shot done.
Candace
Parker, again, phenomenal.
The 600 women thing is kind of, it shouldn't be surprising, but I'm saying the reason it's surprising is because you look at what pre-World War II or around that time frame, kind of what the roles were for women and everything. Was there a structure in place for them playing collegiate sports or anything like that? Where they had not children's leagues, but like rec leagues and stuff?
We'll sort of talk a little bit about that when we get down into the babe. But there was a certain structure of it, but it was like AAU, so amateur athletic stuff.
Okay.
So there was a little bit of just kind of having this and listening to some of these interviews from some of these women. It's kind of the great equalizer of baseball, because when you're growing up and you grow up in a city or anything like that, and there's just a vacant lot, you don't really care who's, if it's all boys or girls or whatever.
That's true.
It's everybody in the neighborhood that's going down there. You can play fucking stickball.
You need positions, you fill positions. Yeah.
And so that was kind of the great thing about it, was these girls, some of them grew up playing softball, but some just grew up playing baseball in the neighborhood with their friends. And then as they grew up, they found a way to either keep playing. There were certain women's like leagues and teams that were playing mostly softball. But when they brought in these 600 women, they traveled like crazy. It was their first season. The way that they did it was just odd, because they wanted to introduce it as baseball, but they still wanted to keep some softball rules. So the first year that they played, all pitching was still underhand, and it was still a 12-inch ball.
Is a 12-inch ball the standard that we play with in softball?
It's a women's softball.
That's a 12-inch ball?
I think the ones that we play with are 13-inch.
Okay.
They're just a fuzz bigger. Whereas a baseball, you're talking 9.5 inches.
Okay.
So a much bigger ball, underhanded pitching still. Wrigley was a very big stickler on wanting these women to still look like women while they played. So just like in League of Their Own, they put them through a full-on charm school.
Okay.
To teach them how to walk, to teach them how to sit.
Was the representation of uniforms in that correct, where it was like, they weren't wearing pants, was it skirts?
Yep.
Okay.
And that was the other thing. And as odd as it was, there were some women that they interviewed that said that they did believe that that was part of the allure of it, was seeing women in skirts playing out there, and that if they had been put in pants.
As misogynist and everything as it sounds, like, there's a fucking lingerie football league.
Yeah. And they're kind of fun to watch. Not necessarily. I mean,
it's fun to watch them fucking take each other out. Like, when they get a big fucking hit.
I'm not a big proponent of violence unless it's like, you both agree to do it.
Equal violence. Yeah.
Equal opportunity violence. Watching two women hit each other, very fun. Watching two men hit each other, very fun. But the fact that they had to wear these dresses, and it was something that had never really come across. Like, watching the show, you think, oh my God, they're like, when you get a raspberry or something like that from sliding, like, it was.
There's a reason that, like, when I play now, I don't wear fucking shorts.
Yep. And it's the same thing. And these women went through it. The crazy thing that I heard over all of this was they used to actually sprinkle the infields with lye to make sure that there wasn't any growth of like plants or anything.
Jesus.
So you're sliding into second base in a skirt on your skin against ground, and there's fucking lye in it. It's just going to
slide
eat away.
Your stomach.
Yeah, dude.
There
and
was no slide in feet first, at least after the first couple slides.
Well, and that's where you hear the competitive edge, because when they're talking in their interviews, they come in, they get the wound cleaned out, the raspberry. They get a little bit of alcohol poured onto it, and they said that all the women would walk around or gather around and, like, blow on the raspberry to try to cool it down. Then they'd have to go out and get right back on the field because they didn't want to get replaced. They wanted to be back out there playing. It was that competitive drive that kept them out there going. They played 108 games the first season. That's a shitload of games.
What's Major League Baseball?
162.
Shit, it's 162. Yeah. What's 112? Is that NBA?
NBA is 82. NHL is 82. I don't know what 112 is. Okay. But the amount of games that they played, and they're traveling in a Midwest area. All those places that I just listed are just kind of right in the breadbasket of America. Mm-hmm. But they're still playing back-to-backs. They're still traveling. They actually got paid fairly decent. I mean, the first year was right around $45 to $85 a week, which is about $780 to like $1,400 bucks a week, which the season ran. It wasn't the longest season, but to get 100 games in.
Oh, yeah, 100. If you're getting 108 games in, you at least need, taking into account, you know, travel time, which is, in this situation, it's going to be by bus everywhere.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's got to at least be, what, five? Even if you're saying 5 months at 30 days, that's only 150. Yeah, maybe if you're cramming that into 150 days, maybe 6 months.
It looks like it was May to August, so three and a half months.
No, that'd be more than that, wouldn't it? May, June, July. Oh, fuck, 4 months.
Yeah, it's a hell of a lot of games.
You're playing almost. You have, even averaging, that gives you 12 days off. Maybe. Jesus.
And that's probably travel days. I mean, you're depending on how you're moving around and how you're going. I just, it's a hell of a schedule.
On the fucking bus. We got to get to the next place we're going, get to a hotel, and then we're playing a game the next day.
And they did. I mean, they were moderately successful. One of their biggest years that they ever had, they brought in 900,000 people for attendance that year, which, granted, doesn't sound like a whole ton.
These aren't major cities, man. No. All the cities that you named, this wasn't a team in Chicago. This wasn't a team in St. Louis. This wasn't a team in Milwaukee. These were teams that were outside of those areas in smaller cities.
And they were actually being taken kind of towards after the war was over, when the whole, when the major leagues were getting back to being the major leagues.
Yeah.
They were bringing these teams in to New York, into Brooklyn, to go play exhibition games before Yankees games, before Dodgers games. I think Brooklyn was still there. I think the Dodgers were still there.
Mm-hmm.
But they were getting to meet all these very... they mentioned getting to meet Joe DiMaggio beforehand.
Yeah.
And the fact that they got to play in these huge stadiums in front of all of these people. And damn, I got the burps. You go play in New York, and then you go back and play in Kenosha.
Yeah.
You just, that juxtaposition of who you're seeing and who you're playing against is wild. It's the fact that they went on for 11 years and that it was able to exist for that long. And I'm assuming that that had to have been profitable, because why would you go for 11 years?
Yeah.
Like, the profits had to be there. And granted, later on, I think it was the last 4 years, they were just teams that were owned within their city. So it was like, ownership is now in baseball or any major sport, but that's still a long time to be going and to be able to create a legacy. When you see a league of their own, you think that it's a year. This was 11 years. That's long.
Yeah, league of their own is basically covering the inception of the actual league itself, how it got started and everything, and probably that first season. What did they do for like a championship?
They did after the 103 games, they went and played a 5-game series, and the first one was Kenosha against Racine. Racine won, and that was it. There was no playoff system or anything like that, but it was a very big deal. I mean, they could have just played these games as exhibitions. Mm-hmm. It could have been a traveling show like you would see, like the Globetrotters or something like that. But these women were so into it and wanted to go so hard that they were playing that many games a year.
Did they ever switch over to more of a baseball format in the sense of pitching and like the ball and everything like that?
Yep. So the first year was the only underhand league that they pitched, and they used, I think it was a 10.5-inch ball until towards the end of the year.
So a mixture between a baseball and then a women's softball. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And they had the pitching mound was like 40 feet away from the plate, which seems very, very short.
Yeah.
But you got to think they are using wood bats back then still, and the balls being a little bit bigger and softer probably aren't going to come off the wood as hard.
I wonder what the pitching speeds were. I mean, I'm not saying that they're going to be slow or anything like that, but traditionally, if you look at a professional or a collegiate softball player, the way they can whip those fucking things underhand, it's pretty fucking fast. But, you know.
Well, and your distance, too. If you're throwing 70 miles an hour, but you're throwing 70 miles an hour from 40 feet instead of 60 feet, it's coming in there a hell of a lot faster than that.
Which I'm assuming that they could probably hit somewhere close to those speeds once they switched over to, you know, overhand pitches with a smaller ball.
And that's one of the reasons that the women as pitchers really didn't like the uniforms was because as a pitcher that first year throwing underhand wearing a skirt, they would actually use safety pins and pin their skirt to basically like one side of a bunch.
Yeah.
So when you brought the ball underhand to whip it, you weren't running into your skirt or anything.
Yeah.
The whole thing, it definitely does seem like the uniforms were probably not the best idea. Good for, a lot of these women were fairly attractive, but good for bringing in crowds. But well, as far as being able to play in it, running around in a skirt, bending over to pick up a ball, anything like that. When you're dropping down for a grounder and you're fighting to get through your skirt to get the ball, it's just not plausible. Well,
the other thing too is, you know, being that it's at the beginning of kind of the inception of this league and they're just trying to get this thing to get some legs to it. The last thing you're going to do is try to change up something that if you're asking people, you know, what brought you out here? What did you want to watch this game? They're like, I just like watching these girls in this or whatever that bullshit is. You're not going to try to essentially take away one of the, I'm not saying it's the predominant reason, but take away any reason for someone to come out to these games to stop watching them.
That's true. Yeah. You want to get everybody through the door for every reason possible. And it seems like they did. That's pretty successful. I understand that 103 games or however many they played, 103 games in a season isn't always 103 games because you're going to have rainouts, you're going to have travel issues.
Well, yeah, and to get to the 103, that's even before the five-game series. So if you're playing with, you said, 12 teams, we're playing against each other, you probably have it to where there's a playoff system, you know, like we get into October for the MLB.
Well, they never did playoffs. It was just the two best teams at the end of the season would play in the
So you would play your full 103 games and just hope that you had the best record by the time that you got to that point.
Yeah, depending on if there were rainouts or if you had travel issues, something like that. So even if they played 80 games, that's still to put up 900,000 people through the gate in some of these small places. These stadiums, and these weren't major league stadiums that they were coming to. These were single A and double A.
Also at a time when people are war rationing.
True.
It's not just materials that they're war rationing. People are also trying to ration money. So to get out to actually pay to go to these games, which I'm not, you know, if they're paying them this much a week, then they're obviously making some type of money off the league. You're still having to take your time to go watch this game. So that's also people putting up their money to do this. So 900,000, especially through the, you know, you could tell that it didn't reach its peak popularity, which is a good thing right out of the gate.
No.
It gained, it seemed like it probably did gain in popularity throughout the time. And especially in 48, that was at a time when people were starting to come back home. You know, people had started to come back home, of course, after 45 in Europe when we went over there. And then later in 45 in Japan, when that portion of the war ended, you're getting people that are just coming back to getting into real life, going back to their jobs and everything. And having something even as simple as a ball game to try to just reestablish some type of normalcy in your life after being in a fucking war for the last, what, 4 or 5 years that you've been over in a foreign country. It does make sense that a couple years later, people are like, yeah, this is fun. Let's fucking do this.
And that was one thing that a lot of the women said was they just came out and would say that we wanted to give these people the best show that we could because we knew that at that time in our country, everybody needed that. Everybody needed a night out. Everybody needed a time to forget lost loved ones, you know, whatever was going on.
Well, and how many of these women, too, had husbands that were serving?
And that's very much part of it. I think we saw it a lot because women predominantly took over a lot of the factory work when men were going off to war. Man.
That's where you get that?
And it just kind of escalated to sports too. So not only are you having women working in factories to keep the country running, you're looking towards entertainment wise women out there slinging the ball and hitting the ball. And it just overall seems like it's something in history that is fun to look at and to know that it was there, and hopefully it lives on. You see, I can't remember her name, she was just in the Little League World Series that pitched.
Oh, the girl that was the pitcher that got all the buzz around her. What was her name? Oh, man.
she, to see her out there with the boys, though, just making it happen, and
Monet.
Yeah.
Money. Monet. Yeah.
Monet Davis. Yeah, she was out there outplaying the boys. And at that sort of a young age, that's why I think baseball is great, is when you get older, your bodies change a little bit. But in Little League and in those times, the playing field doesn't matter if you're a boy or a girl.
Yeah.
You're going to go out there, and no matter how hard you work, you're going to be able to get out there on the field.
It's more of a level playing field at that point. Not for everybody, of course, but you do have, you know, your outliers like Monet Davis, who fucking could sling the goddamn rock. And
you are seeing it more. You're seeing more females at the college level that are on these baseball teams. Not necessarily the starting pitchers or anything like that, but there are women that are making the strides that they want to make in a male-dominated sport. Mm-hmm. Which is,
I love it when they do the when you see the videos of like the football team.
Oh yeah,
when the football players go out and the fucking girls are just smoking the fucking pitches past them, and they got all the fucking other team in the background over in the dugout just being like, oh, and then one guy ends up getting a hit out of like 20,
yep,
and they're just like, yeah.
Or you'll see they'll do occasionally. Jenny Finch will get out there and throw underhand to a former MLB player, mm-hmm, and just watch her embarrass the shit out of somebody, yep, with a rise ball, or you, mm-hmm, watch her throw a rise and it just cuts down right at the end and you see him duck out of the way like, mm-hmm, they thought it was coming for him. It's like, you don't see that shit.
Here's the thing that I can point to, especially with the probably the quality of their play, is that I jumped onto a team for I think two games, and they have a men's fast pitch,
yeah,
underhand fast pitch softball league here, and it's fucking scary, man, being in that box and having, because you're used to seeing like when someone, you know, it's nervous enough, you know, it's nerve-wracking enough when you're standing there. And the mechanics of an overhead, you know, an overhand pitch, you can see the ball, unless they're a lefty, you can see the ball coming at you from a certain degree.
You can see the spin as soon as it
leaves. And it's coming high. Fingered.
Yep.
Only time it's going down. If it stays high, you know not to swing, you can get out of the way. When that thing is fucking coming from a hip level,
uh-huh,
and everything, it never gets higher than your fucking, like, you know, between your chest and your legs. It's fucking scary because it's an unnatural thing to be watching as a man trying to hit that, and you're just like, oh, this fucking thing is humming.
Well, and it just, like you say, your level of perception to pick something up coming waist height, you don't see the kind of spin that it comes out, mm-hmm, of the hand, because it's coming from such a low trajectory to where you don't see the fingers. Really,
I don't understand the mechanics of a women's softball pitch,
no,
in that how they do not just consistently destroy, and I know that they do, but to be able to do that for however many innings they're pitching in that game, I know there's a pitch count management, but that motion in itself seems so just violent on your fucking arm and your joints and your shoulder and everything. But for them to just be whipping that shit consistently, like these are full on, I don't want anyone to be mistaken about this. These are full on athletes at the top of their game. But to have something like this that serves as kind of a precursor to all that. I wonder, you know, if you look at the what happened after this league, there was probably a huge boom in participation for girls wanting to get into something like this that probably really did spur not really the explosion, but the development of girls' collegiate teams and things like that.
Well, even if it didn't blow it up, it still kept it alive.
Yeah.
It still kept the desire to be there. Mm-hmm. It was a representation of them seeing it. And I got to admit, I watched probably 20 innings of women play baseball just doing the research. It was always good. It, mm-hmm, was always fun. It just, every single thing that happened, when you see somebody take a grounder to shortstop and they whip it to first, or they turn a double play,
mm-hmm,
doesn't matter if you're male, female, whatever, just watching that motion happen and seeing just the, I take pleasure in watching a good double play,
yeah,
and to see it happen, it was just great to see it in the old black and white grainy footage too, mm-hmm, where it seems like everybody's moving just so much faster than, yeah, they really are. It was a lot of fun to watch and enjoy, and I could totally see like that being a very good night out.
Yeah.
And like we said, dude, the later years, they were making almost, in today's money, $2,200 a week. And granted, it wasn't a full-time, full-year's job, but that's a decent amount of money.
I mean,
$125 a week for a woman back then was probably pretty good.
Yeah.
I would say that would be better than just a regular traditional job.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
So, yeah, I feel like that's most of what I have for the AAG PBL. Wish they would have shortened the name. I'm not sure. Oh, yeah, well, All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. Unfortunately, tongue-in-cheek, still segregated, still didn't happen. They make reference to that, I believe, in the movie.
Mm-hmm. I think, yeah.
Unfortunate that it happened that way, but we were just not at the time in our country. They were having trouble having women go out there and look like men playing ball. They weren't going to allow integration to happen at that point.
Well, we just talked about that last week. Yeah. Just the fact that even armed services and certain jobs within the armed services, it took a fuck ton of stuff just to get that to go through to where they could serve as pilots and everything. So it's not, it's shittily not surprising.
No, the other thing that they said was any Latin women could mm-hmm. play as long as they looked white enough. So if your name was like Betty Ortega, you could probably make it happen. Mm-hmm. Like Betty Hernandez.
Yeah.
Abigail Hernandez could go out there and play as long as she didn't look too...
Wipe the fucking field with everybody.
Just, yeah. That's probably what it was, too. They're like, this chick can throw from third to first without skipping. Uh-huh. Where is she from?
Yep. We're going to need to see your documentation. You're throwing way too fucking well here. You're not giving these other girls a fair shot.
They didn't have a steroids issue. They had a Latin issue. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So that's number one on our list. I'm going to go ahead and jump in here. So I'm going to go ahead and take us back a little bit further than this, quite a bit further. We're going to go and discuss Joan of Arc.
I'm going to be honest. I know her name and I kind of know what she did. Don't know a lot about her.
I think that's commonplace though.
Yeah.
Thinking about it, I think that I'm trying to take myself back to my old schooling days to try to remember how much time was dedicated to Joan of Arc. And I'm not even lying. I think throughout the course of learning about European and French history, Joan of Arc's name was mentioned maybe a paragraph, if that, and you're not getting a lot of information. And
what I pick her up from is she's so high above me.
She's so lovely.
Yep. She gets mentioned in there along with
everybody. I don't
else.
Know if Joan was lovely. I'm not going to lie to you. Some of the pictures, it's hard to tell from, you know, French paintings and stuff like that. What Joan was is a lot more than what we learn about. And I was thinking about this today is that we have such a, thanks to movies and things like that, we're able to see things that are supposed to just completely blow our minds. And we have this weird kind of unappreciation for real scenarios and real people because we've seen fictional people do such amazing things that could never be done by a fictional person. And going through, I'm not even shitting you, man, going through Joan of Arc's time frame in which she is known and what her story takes place, it takes place literally throughout the course of maybe a year. And she's a patron saint of France. So I'll just go ahead and kind of knock out the early years, because not a lot happened. So she was born in 1412 in a place called, the way they pronounce it, it's Domremy, but it sounds like Do-Re-Mi. Oh, when a bunch of people pronounce it, so I don't know if that has Do-Re-Mi.
Fucking French, man.
Yeah. Into the peasant class. And peasant class is exactly what it sounds like. You maybe get a little bit of land, but you're serving under essentially what the fiefdom of like a lord or whoever looks over your area. And you're out there plowing the fields, you know, trying to gather your wheat or grain or whatever. It's not a great life.
A feudal system where all mm-hmm. you're doing is making money for the landowner to be able to keep you on there.
Exactly. And if you're lucky, you get to keep enough to keep your family alive. And not only was she born into the peasant class, but she was born during the Hundred Years' War between France and England. So just to kind of give you an idea of, and this is going to set the stage for how crazy her story is. So the Hundred Years' War was basically the French King Charles VI. He was nicknamed Charles the Beloved, and then later in his life, Charles the Mad. So real, real 180 there.
Yeah, real heel turn.
He started having recurring bouts of like mental illness, to where he at one point became convinced that his body was made of glass and tried to design like a cage contraption to keep himself from breaking. At one point, I think he killed 5 people in one day within his court because he thought there was a conspiracy against him. So he started going crazy after he was beloved.
funny how that shit happened back then. Like, we just got to believe him. Now it's like, it's there was a mental health issue here.
Medication was like fucking mercury.
Yeah. And yeah, shit. Which didn't help. It just made it worse. No, it just made you crazier.
And so his cousin, his name was John, the Duke of Burgundy. Charles had a brother that was there's a lot of dukes here. Had a brother named Louis, the Duke of Orleans. And John, the Duke of Burgundy, which was the cousin of the king, ends up hiring these dudes to kill Louis in Paris. He's out walking in Paris. These guys jump him and beat the shit out of him with clubs, so much so that they almost took like limbs off by beating him to death. This basically created a civil war. And during the civil war in France, King Charles, King Henry V of England, he basically used that division. He was like, I think I have some right to France, and so I'm going to go and use this to invade. He had, of course, didn't have really right. There was a lot of intermarrying between like the French royal family and the British royal family, but then there was also a lot of bad blood and shit that happened here.
Well, and as we know over history, having the right is just usually having the bigger army.
That's pretty much. And what's weird here is the population of France at this point was like 20 million. Population of England was 2 million. But damn. England was kind of cleaning the floor with France. And King Charles the Beloved and the Mad, he had a son, Charles the Seventh. He became what they call the Dauphin, which is basically fancy with a French word for prince, after his four older brothers had died. So King Charles the Seventh, his supporters are called the Armagnacs. And then the Duke of Burgundy, John, his supporters are called the Burgundians. Not really clever in that sense. So Henry V, again, he's coming in. He is able to basically take over most of northern France. He takes Paris and kind of pushes the actual like French country down into, I think, like the lower two-thirds of France. So he's got everything from England going all the way down past Paris a little bit. And the French royalty, essentially, they needed, you know, Charles the Seventh. He's younger at this time. I want to say when he takes over, when his father dies, he's in his like late teens, early 20s. And coincidentally enough, Henry V and King Charles the Sixth, they both die in like 1422, within like 2 months of each other. And what happened was King Henry of England, Britain, whatever you want to call it, he ends up marrying someone from a French royal family under the impression that like, hey, my heir is going to have a claim to the throne of France. So he does it as a strategic move.
But he basically tries to make it a birthright.
Pretty much. But Charles the Seventh is actually the rightful king, but he's not able to be crowned because in order to be crowned the legitimate, and there was a thought believed to be able to be crowned the legitimate king of France, you had to be crowned in the traditional place where your coronation, it was called a place called, I think it's Reims, R-E-I-M-S, Reims, I'm not sure how they pronounce it. So Joan, she grows up in an area that is a loyal Armagnac area, but she's pretty much surrounded by areas that are loyal to the Burgundians. And the Burgundians at some point kind of have this deal with the English that they're kind of fighting. They're not fighting against the English, but they're not really allies. They're just kind of a, hey, you don't fuck with us, we don't fuck with you type situation.
Yeah, a little isolationist kind of.
Yeah, so Joan has her first, she starts having visions. This is the thing with Joan that I don't think really gets brought up. People just say that she's, you know, a saint of France. She helped with the army and everything like that. Well, what led her to actually do that is I think when she was at age 13, she had her first vision. And it was in 1425, the Burgundians, they actually attacked Domremy and basically stole a bunch of cattle. And at that point, the consensus in the area was like, we got to kick these fuckers out of France. They're starting to harass us now and everything. She's out doing something. I can't remember what she was doing. She feels like she hears this voice behind her and she turns around. No one's there. But then she has a vision and it's Saint Michael. And Saint Michael was a patron saint of France. He was a patron saint of Domremy. And throughout her life, she would have visions of Saint Michael and then these two other saints, Saint Margaret and Saint Catherine, which were, I think, both also French saints around the same area. She swore a vow of virginity to these saints. She led a really traditional, like, pious life. She was very religious, never put a foot out of line or anything like that, didn't, you know, stir the shit. And they basically, these saints told her that she had to get Charles VII to Reims to where he could be traditionally coronated as the French king.
The leader.
Well, unfortunately, Reims is under Burgundian control. And so for the first couple years that she has these visions, she keeps going to whoever the duke of that area was or whoever was in charge, the lord of that area. And she's like, hey, I need to get down to this place called Chinon. I don't know. It's C-H-I-N-O-N. I don't know how it's pronounced in France. Chinon. I'm just going to call it Chinon. And that's where Charles had been holding up shop and where his royal court was at the time. So the lord's like, no, you're like a fucking like 13 or 14 year old girl. What are you fucking talking about? You had visions or anything like that? Get the fuck out of here.
Get back to the field.
Pretty much. So she ends up during this time over the next couple of years, she kind of gathers a couple followers. A handful maybe. But there was this prophecy about an armed virgin that would save France. Wasn't particular if it was male or female. But
just a virgin.
Yes. And this prophecy had been kind of a longer standing prophecy before she came into the world and everything. So 1428, she first requests an armed escort to get to Charles. She's denied. January 1429, she goes and makes another request. Again, it's denied. And when Henry died, Henry V, his brothers actually continued the conquest of France. They didn't just pack their shit up and leave. And finally, in February of 1429, she gets an escort of 6 soldiers. I think maybe the Lord was like, okay, you have a couple more followers. Some people are starting to buy into this. What's going to be the harm? We're losing this shit. So what could be? Yeah.
Yeah. If you're plan X, we're going to plan X.
Yes. So he gives her an escort of 6 soldiers. They dress her up like a dude and they get down to Chinon to talk to Charles. And at this point, once she puts on these men's clothes, she wears them for the rest of her life. Not the same set of clothes, but she dresses like a man for the rest of her life.
Like a boy.
Yep. It's also going to make it safer for her to travel and everything. So March 1429, so the wheels are fucking turning on this thing. It turns very quickly. She actually meets Charles at the royal court in Chinon, and she's 17 years old at this point. She convinces him that she was there to break the siege of Orleans, which at this point, Reims is kind of like a straight shot from Chinon, but there's a couple places in between. The reason that France was able to, or the French army was able to kind of halt the English assault is there was a river. And at that point of history, a river is basically the best natural defense. Aren't a lot of bridges. Getting across a large river takes a lot of resources to build a stone bridge or to get an army across a river.
Yeah, and the other side can just sit there and volley arrows and everything at you while you're trying to get across.
So the English are basically besieging or have a siege of Orleans at this point. Part of it's still kind of in French control, but the other side of it on the other side of the river, English control, and then there's a bridge that's really the only crossing point.
This has to be where New Orleans came from, right?
Yes. So they're still holding this, but if Orleans falls, it's pretty much a shot straight to Chinon. And so she's like, hey, I'm here to basically break the siege of Orleans and get you to Reims. And they have a private conversation between her and Charles, and it's not really known what they said, but there's something that she mentions to him that convinces him in a way that I don't know if she just kind of like fluffs him up a little bit to be like, hey, you are the rightful king of France. These were my visions. And they're not just like, okay, cool. They actually do a bunch of vetting on her where they actually talk to like the lord of the area and a bunch of other people who are like, yeah, she's actually led a very pious life. She's pretty legitimate. Never seemed like a crazy person or anything like that. And she's like,
aside from the visions.
At this point, though, like,
everybody had visions back then.
There were saints and people that had been like holy people. And so, how many times have you heard like, this is the will of God, that my right to rule is divine by God and everything. So I don't think it's really.
The church still uses that.
And it's a pretty desperate situation, I think, for France.
Oh, yeah. Well, like you say, this wasn't plan A, B, or C. No,
and they don't have a ton to lose. So she gets some armor, and they designed this suit of armor just for her. And it's got like kind of like a chainmail skirt and everything like that on it. It's like a weird mix of like men's armor and kind of like they like kind of make it into like kind of women's armor or anything like that.
It was breastplate.
I think it was pretty flat in that scenario, because all the pictures show it, and it looks like they just kind of modified men's armor just a little bit. And it's a 17-year-old girl, so it's probably a smaller version of armor.
Yeah. Titties on the front of a breastplate, though, seems like that would be a good way to fire off arrows. Because it wouldn't be just a straight shot.
It's like when they were designing tanks, how they had curvature to it. Uh-huh. So if they take a direct shot, it would kind of try to ricochet right off. Yeah. So they get her some armor and send her with an army to go relieve the siege of Orleans. Now, she's never really given actual military command or anything like that. She's basically kind of there as an advisor. And the whole point is that she made Charles believe that, hey, my role is to help with this to get you to your coronation. So they end up getting around Orleans, and the English have set up forts kind of all along it. She basically is there for every siege of all these forts, and they're just taking these forts. She basically gets to a point where she relieves Orleans. She's shot by an arrow between the shoulder and the neck, gets taken back to like a medical tent or whatever, gets treated, rallies, and then just goes right back out to inspire the troops. They said what she rode in with is she would ride in on her horse with she had a sword. She never killed anybody.
What?
Throughout the entire course of this. No. And she got into, and she was always in the thick of shit on the front lines, climbing ladders. There's a situation where she actually goes to climb a ladder, to like siege, like, a fort wall, and has a rock dropped on top of her head and it cracks her helmet. So she's in the thick of shit, but she never kills anybody during this entire time.
She's like Batman.
Well, Batman does kill people, actually. Mm. Contrary to popular belief, he does. Indirectly or directly, yeah, Batman has killed some fucking people.
Directly.
Well, what happens is they end up relieving the Siege of Orleans and the English retreat. So at this point, everything Jonah said she's going to do, she's done at this point.
She's making good on all of her promises.
Yep, and the English retreat in May. So, I mean, like literally 2 months after they, you know, send her out there, Orleans has been relieved of this siege that they've been under for a long-ass time. So she has this belief, because she feels like she is protected and sent by God, that regardless of kind of the situation of like the number of troops against them and everything, that she just keeps telling him, she's like, no, we're pushing forward. We need to keep pushing forward to get this shit taken care of. They're like, well, what about this? She's like, we have God on our side. Like, it'll work. And crazily enough, there's three other towns that are kind of on the way to Reims, and they have to clear them in order to get there. So one of them is called Jargeau. And basically Joan comes in, she tells the English to surrender. And she's like, all right, they refuse. She suggests a full frontal assault the next day, and the town is taken by the end of it. So again, she's two for two at that point. Like I was telling you, she serves in the thick of the fighting while she's climbing up to siege like a wall and everything to get over a wall. She gets hit in the head by a helmet. It doesn't look like it knocks her out or anything, but it splits her helmet. They go to another place called Mont-sur-Loire. French win again on June 15th. Then they go to a place called Beaugency. And apparently in Loire, they had sent a letter to Beaugency and were like, hey, we're surrendering, we're retreating and everything. Beaugency just surrenders on June 18th. So she's three for three at this point. And Joan is like, keep fucking moving forward. Yeah. We're going to keep pushing. This is working for us.
If we're not losing these, we got to keep going. And she's leading from the front, unlike probably any other general before her.
She's there in the thick of the shit. And yeah. I mean, she's a symbol. Like, basically all of these guys, after these first couple of victories, they're looking at her and being like, we have the angel of France or some shit with us. Like, we're winning when she's here.
She can't die.
So they get to the point where they go to this Battle of Patay, and the English think they have an ace up their sleeve because, you know, I'm not sure how big the armies are. I don't imagine they're very massive or anything, but they're probably decent size. So the English hide all of these archers in the woods, and they're expecting to kind of like catch them in an enveloping position. Mm-hmm. Regardless of how this has happened, or if this, it just happens a different way, but the archers get spooked and alert themselves to the French. Somehow, some say that like a stag ran through their lines and it freaked out a whole bunch of like of the English archers, and they made their positions known, and the Armagnacs are able to detect them and basically just decimate the entire English army at that point. Joan gets there after the fact of this battle being won, but it was her strategy to keep pushing and to keep moving forward. So they're like, she may not have been here, but this was her call to, you know, to have us keep pushing and keep taking these areas. So at this point, they've actually got to Reims and have secured Reims enough to where Charles can come in. French leaders are like, we're fucking like four for four at this point. Let's keep pushing them. Let's push them all the way to Normandy and kick them off French soil. Joan's like, nope, That's not what my fucking job was here. So she insists that they basically stop the attack. And she's like, bring Charles in. So Charles basically rides in, rides into the cathedral, like on his horse. And the cardinal, whoever was there, the bishop, basically crowns Charles VII as the rightful king of France. And sitting right next to him during this ceremony is Joan of Arc.
As she should be. She should be the one probably getting the crown at that point, because she's led a military just tour de force, basically.
And I mean, technically, she's not in charge of the military, but these generals or whoever's in charge are kind of taking her advice to do this. And she's the common factor with all of this success. So basically, Paris is next. And Paris, I didn't know this, like the geography of Paris, but apparently the Seine River, whatever, in Paris, it divides Paris, and there's a section of like central Paris that's actually on an island. Yeah. But then the rest of it is actually divided by the Seine, whatever you want to say.
Probably so, between the River Thames.
Yeah, but it's Seine really fortified because it's on a fucking island and everything. Yeah. So they decide that Paris is next. And during this, Joan is actually shot in the thigh with a crossbow bolt and is basically in a trench, and they have to wait till like nightfall to retrieve her. Well, what ends up happening is she's like, no, fuck it. Continue the attack. And Charles is like, nah, this isn't working out for us right now. I'm king. I got kind of what I wanted at this point.
I got what I needed.
Let's take a break. And so because of this loss, this one loss that didn't go their way, you know, Charles kind of loses faith in her. And some other people are like, okay, at this point, oh shit, she's like 4 for 5 now. Maybe the fairy dust is kind of worn off in this. So she's sent on some random assignments and returns to court in December. So throughout this time, there's like another 5 months where she's sent out to try to kind of clear some of these Burgundians and English out of the countryside and kind of keep fighting the good fight. I think at this point, she's still very much a symbol of hope and like morale for these troops. The know of her at this point, she's probably kind of legendary. Like Joan, she wasn't known as Joan of Arc. D'Arc was her family surname, but no one went by their surname. And her name was like Jeanne or something like that, but we anglicized it and made it Joan. So she returns back to court in December that same year and finds out that Charles basically ennobled her and her entire family, so made them nobles for her contributions to all this. Yeah, fantastic. She got something out of it. Well, she is still not satisfied. So she decides to keep fighting the Burgundians, and there's a little bit of like questionable as far as like strategy is. Was she actually like permitted by Charles to keep kind of fighting in these other areas? She had men with her of the French army. So to say that she just kind of did that on her own is probably not very realistic, because not a lot of guys are going to go against the king to just go keep fighting with her. But she ends up getting captured May 23rd of 1430. So that next year she's fighting again. She's right in the thick of it and everything. Again, never fucking kills anyone, but she ends up getting surrounded by some Burgundian troops and gets pulled off of her horse. So, and she's known, you know.
Oh, yeah.
She's
the other side definitely knows about her.
And the other side had actually thought that she might be some type of like demon. Like the English thought that she might be like some demonic figure or something like that, because she was so successful against them. And of course, you're going to try to demonize your enemy.
Yep. Always.
So they end up selling her to the English. And she tries to escape at one point by jumping out a 70-foot window into a dry moat. And she gets injured, but she doesn't die.
What? She was up 7 stories, basically, and jumped down into a dry moat and didn't...
A dry moat and doesn't...
Oh, yeah. A dry moat.
But at the same time, it's still a dry moat. I don't know if it's mud or what it is and everything, but she gets injured, but she doesn't die. So they end up putting her...
She might be a demon.
Maybe. They end up putting her on trial, and I'm not sure if it takes place in northern France or if it ends up taking place in England. Sorry, I didn't get that far into it, but it's basically like a kangaroo court. And it's overseen by this bishop. I can't remember what his name is, but they put her on trial for heresy. And basically kind of some of the charges, there were like 60 charges against her, and they whittled it down to 12 that they think they could really go after. It wasn't that they didn't just like burn her or hang her or anything like that. Their whole strategy during this trial was to get her to recant that all of the stuff that she said about the visions, about, you know, Charles being the rightful ruler of France. If she could recant that and say it was bullshit, then it went against his legitimacy for the actual crown.
Well, that and the English being very religious driven, knowing that God was on her side and fighting for
they're
the
trying
French.
To turn it into a fact where like it, she was a demon and that they're the ones that are like the, you know, the soldiers of God and all that stuff. So they need her to basically confess to the fact that, you know, heresy, basically,
yeah,
witchcraft.
Like, heresy on anybody.
Exactly. They accused her of witchcraft and all this stuff. But basically, some of the charges that they kind of tried to try her on, wearing men's clothes, acting on demonic visions, and refusing to submit words and deeds to the church, and because all she said was she would be judged by God alone. So they bring her, and the way that apparently there was a system of putting someone on trial that was it was pretty legitimate, but a lot of the courtesies or procedures, usually as a woman, she would have to be looked after and tended by women. She was guarded by men. She was treated unfairly within, like, when she was being confined and everything like that. And they did all of this because they basically just wanted her to admit and recant all of her beliefs and everything like that, say she was crazy, just because then it would illegitimize Charles. That heir on Henry's side would then have a more legitimate claim for it, yada, yada. And it got to the point during the trial where even some of the clerics in the trial felt that her testimony was being coerced. And then another cleric challenged the bishop in charge to say that and suggested that the way he was conducting himself, that he maybe didn't even have the right to be in the position that he was in to be trying her. And that guy was thrown in jail.
So even the Englishmen were starting to see Joan as a...
couple of them. They just saw that, you know, it was about the rule of law at that point. I guess if England was anything, it was going to be a lawful society. And saw that this bishop was doing and that it wasn't along the lines of what they felt that they needed to be conducting themselves on, especially against a woman in this scenario. Well, she ended up being found guilty. And what happened is that at certain points they would bring her in and have torturers there and have them with all their instruments and being like, listen, we don't want to have to torture you, but if you're not going to come clean and give us the truth, then we're going to have to do this. The entire time, what was so convincing about her was that at no point did she seem crazy. She seemed very lucid. She was very eloquent. She's a peasant girl, too. Her story was always consistent. She was very eloquent about how she went about it. She was very determined in her beliefs and that she was doing the right thing in the name of God and the visions that she'd been presented. And at one point, I don't know if they scared her enough, but she agreed to sign something that said basically she was recanting her statement about all that kind of stuff. They took her into her cell. They gave her different clothes, women's clothes. And the next day that they came back, she had dressed back into her men's clothes. And they're like, what's going on here? And she was kind of acting weird and everything like that. And one of the guys asked her, he's like, you had another vision, didn't you? And she admitted that she had another vision. And that she was being told that because she had gone against her convictions and basically went against what her beliefs were, that she was going to be damned. And so she was like, I'm not going to do this. She went back. She's like, that thing I signed for you guys, it was under coercion, all this shit. I recant that. I'm sticking with my original story. And because of that, she was found guilty and they burned her at the stake at 19 years old. They didn't just burn her.
19.
They didn't just burn her once either. They burned her, and as they were burning her, I think they heard her last words where she was muttering, Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. She was always thinking at some point that maybe she was going to be rescued, like, you know, at the very last second, everything like that. She thought that Charles may try to, like, launch a rescue or something like that. He didn't even attempt it.
She did a lot
it.
For him. Maybe he's going to
step
even, in.
Yeah, he didn't even fucking attempt it or anything like that. And so they burned her the first time. When you're being burned, part of the executioner's job apparently is to minimize suffering, despite the fact they're fucking burning you alive.
You don't minimize burning.
No. So what they're supposed to do is after a certain point, they're supposed to essentially kill you to ease your suffering. Well, the way that the stake and the pyre was set up to burn her is it was set up in a position where it was higher and the guy couldn't get to her. So she died by the actual burning itself, smoke inhalation, whatever it was.
It's a rough way to go.
After they burned her, something about her body still being too intact, her organs, everything, they burned her again. And then there's even another story in which they burn her a third time. And then they end up just throwing her ashes in some river or some shit. 19 years old, man. She did all of this within the course of about, 2 years from the time that she actually met Charles to the time that she was burned. And eventually in March 1922, she is declared a patron saint of France. And her feast day is May 30th.
Why would it? I guess I can't say that because we live in a country where it takes hundreds of years before people are granted sainthood, and I guess not sainthood, but medals of freedom, different things like
that. Yeah, when you're posthumously? Is it posthumously? Well, you're awarded, like, you know, the Medal of Honor and things like that. But I think kind of what, and there's, of course, about the visions and everything is, you know, society has progressed and everything. People look back at it and they're like, well, these could have been the mental issues that she possibly had. She could have been possibly schizophrenic. Part of, I think, a certain, like, part of schizophrenia is that you do hear voices, disembodied voices and everything. She obviously had these visions all the way up until from the time she first had them as a girl. She had them all the way up until the end of her life. But putting all that aside.
It didn't matter. It worked.
It did. But putting all that aside, you have a 17-year-old peasant girl who convinces the king of France to trust her. Not only that, but she makes good on her word, inspires the country to essentially take back their country enough to get this guy to the place where his coronation is going to be the most legitimate. And by doing so, you know, had she not done anything and they would have made a misstep or done something different than what she would have done, it could have essentially been, we could have been looking at, you know, South England or South Britain.
Oh, yeah.
Sitting down below them. So, like I was saying before, I think we've seen so many fictional, fantastical things within our lives that just breaking this down and saying, this girl, 17-year-old peasant girl, was a hero of an entire country, helped out a king, and then was kind of unfortunately left out to dry after doing all of this. I mean, I don't know what they really could have done if, you know, they were deep into enemy occupied territory, but I mean, at least she did end up getting recognized. She, you know, was made a saint and everything like that.
Took a few hundred years, but they still
took a few hundred years, but they finally decided to go through on that. But just like, I don't even know what to compare that to. That would be like if we had somebody that was, I guess, president, or like even think of like during the Civil War where you had, you know, the leader of the Confederacy, leader of the Union, and someone, a 17-year-old girl came to one of them and was like, hey, I have the keys to the kingdom to make you, to win you this war. Like, that's fucking crazy.
That wouldn't happen.
No.
We wouldn't let that happen.
No. But just the simple fact that somebody that came from nothing was able to rise to essentially a sainthood, man. Like, to the highest levels that you can to be recognized like that. And not a lot of people, frankly, probably, you know, 95, 96% of people know the cursory details of Joan of Arc was a hero of France, and she helped the French. Well, people are like, did she kill a bunch of people? She never killed a person. She was just such an inspiration, and somehow through the voices in her head, just had this tactic in her mind that we're just going to keep fighting. And who knows, the English could have been like, fuck, they've never attacked us like this before. They've never pushed on us like this before. And it could have been simply an error on their side, but it took her to do this. And that to me is just fucking baddest bitch in, you know, one of the baddest bitches in history, worthy of recognition. And it's a crazy story and a crazy true story. So that's, I think, the biggest thing is just to recognize that is something, you know, something from nothing.
No, and her light didn't burn long, but it burned hot and it burned fast. And
it's better to burn out than fade away.
Exactly. Yeah, she kicked ass. I didn't even realize that she would have been that young just all throughout it. You hear Joan of Arc, and like you say, my cursory knowledge wasn't great. But to know that it wasn't like an actual woman who was 30, 40 years old.
She wasn't like some noblewoman or anything like that had any influence in that country. She was nothing.
Yeah, we don't look towards 17-year-olds as the leaders of our country today, but back then she saved a whole entire country from being South England.
Yeah, exactly.
That's crazy.
All right, bathroom break before we jump into the last two?
Yeah.
Awesome. All right, while we take a break from class and take care of some business, you can also take care of some business.
If you don't follow us on Instagram or Twitter already, our Instagram handle is Historically High Pod. That's Historically High P-O-D. And our Twitter is Historically High. That's Historically H-I.
All right, and back to our show. All right, getting back to it. So we've covered a group of bad bitches.
Yep.
One of the, probably maybe the baddest bitch in France, in French history.
Absolutely.
Who is up next?
The Babe. And she got her nickname,
is it an ironic nickname?
Well, she got named after Babe Ruth because she was such a just shockingly good softball and baseball player growing up. Her name was Mildred Babe Diedrichsen, and her last name, she goes from Diedrichsen to Diedrichsen Zaharias as she gets married. But she was born June 26, 1911 in Port Arthur, Texas. And to say that she was, like, just touched by the sports gods from the start is really an understatement. She, just growing up, she had an affinity for sports. She absolutely loved it. She was a great softball player, great baseball player. Like I said, they actually nicknamed her.
A natural.
Yeah, and that's, she really was the natural before Robert Redford or whoever did it. I mean, she was nicknamed the Babe because they reminded her of Babe Ruth while she was playing baseball as a kid. As a high school player, she actually quit high school to kind of pursue professional sports because she was just that good. And when I say that good, I'm not even talking about like good as just a singular person. Her track and field accomplishments are just really second to none.
You've already said baseball, golf, yeah, and track and field at this point.
We're going to be covering a lot of sports. So after she leaves high school and kind of gets out into the world, she is brought in by, back then they had AAU, which is Amateur Athletes Union, but they would hold events and these events would almost be precursors to the Olympics. So
kind of like what you would have as, what do they call them now? Like national events.
Yeah. Trials kind of.
Yeah. Like, okay. The Olympic. You're okay, able gotcha.
To get yourself in there. So before these track and field events in 1932, she played for a semi-professional basketball league that had, I don't know as far as countries go, they had national championships. She went to two national finals in the 2 years that she played basketball for this team. She ended up winning
Now we're on basketball?
Yeah. So as a basketball player, like fresh out of high school, she went to two national finals. She won one national championship. Then the next year, following in 1932, she was at a track and field AAU event where she not only competed in individual events, she was actually put in as a team herself.
In like what events?
So she did, I believe it was 9 events that she had held that day. She won 6 of them, tied first for one of them. And through the overall team competition, she actually won the team competition. The second place team was a team of 20 women that only scored her grand total after winning all these events by herself.
And this was at one of these national.
Yeah, like, it was at a national event. So I believe it was.
Was it win from other countries?
It was national.
Okay.
So it was in America. But she won the 80 meter hurdles, the javelin, the high jump. 3 other events along those lines. One of them was like the shot put, softball throw, just absolutely crushed it. And like I say, when you do like
teams, okay, state how big she was.
She was only, I mean, back then, 5'7", 126 pounds as an adult. That's a fairly.
So then it wasn't, you know, nicknamed Bay because she was built like a sturdy gal. She was not. It was just that it was based on her dominance alone.
She was fine-tuned, and she was just that good at all of her sports. So like I say, to go over this AAU event, in the team scoring, herself alone winning all of these events, she scored 30 points for the whole entire track and field event. The next closest team was a 20-woman team. The runners-up only scored 22 points as a 20-woman team. So obviously,
and having people as part of that team that specialized in those events.
She was beating their asses by herself. That earned her enough to go to the Olympics in 1932 in Los Angeles. The Olympics in Los Angeles, she won gold in, it was, where was it? She won gold in the javelin in the 80 meter hurdles and took silver in the high jump. And the only reason that she took silver in the high jump was she had a different method of doing it, where you've heard of like the Fosbury flop.
Which is what we know today. Fosbury flop is what the traditional high jump. You approach it running, and at the last second, you run to the side of it, and you're doing a backwards jump that allows you to kick your legs over it.
And you can clear your back, and then you bring your legs and everything up over the front. She was jumping the opposite way, where she was jumping, diving. Clearing it with her stomach.
She was diving over it.
Yeah, kicking her legs up and over the top of it. So on a world stage, not only just talking about in America, on a world stage, she took gold in javelin, the 80-meter hurdles, and silver in the high jump. And you would think that that would be something where, like, pretty big feather in your cap. Like, that, if that's the most important, impressive thing that you did, that's a very impressive thing.
Did you see where she acquired the actual nickname, Babe?
It was because they nicknamed her that after Babe Ruth, right?
Well, yeah. So she hit 5 home runs in a childhood baseball game, and everybody called her Babe after that. But her mother had actually called her, like, BB or something like that. And so it was just a natural progression. But Jesus.
Yeah, Mildred's a rough name. So Babe definitely came across at the right time. You would think that that would be the highlight of somebody's life. Didn't even come close. So after that, she had a real affinity for playing golf. She's actually the reason that the LPGA was created. She was a co-creator in the
LPGA.
LPGA.
LGBTPGA.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I was going to get an acronym very wrong there. But during that time, she won, it was 10 majors in that time frame of after 1932. She didn't live long. She lived until 1956. She died of colon cancer, which sucks because she was just an all-out star. She had actually in 1938 become the first woman to compete in a men's golf event, and this was prior to LPGA, so she was still technically considered an amateur.
Yeah,
she was given professional status to play with these men. She didn't end up winning
probably the tournament. Only people that she could compete against.
Yeah,
meaning that nobody else was even in her league.
No, yeah, she was kind of like the Annika Sorenstam of this time, except for she was just that much better. So after she played in the professional men's event, she bumped back down to being an amateur. As she was an amateur, she was an amateur in 1946. She won the U.S. Women's Amateur Tournament, and then the next year she won 17 championships at 17 different events.
Well, the only reason, too, I'm looking here, the only reason that she got the silver, she lost to another American named Gene Shilley. The only reason, the pair tied at a jump off when the bar was raised to 1.67 meters, so 5.5 feet, sorry. Uh-huh. But Shilley was awarded the gold after she was ruled to have used an improper technique.
Which was the over.
Yeah, the but bar, at the same time, who the fuck cares? Like, I guess they had to, what, were they just trying to find a way to not continue it, to like figure out who they could give it to? That's ridiculous. The only reason people use that flop now is because it allows them to get more height.
Yeah, and it leverages your body to where you can lift the second half of yourself up and over.
Yeah.
The and we're talking, you said 5'5", she was 5'7", so she was basically jumping over herself almost at that point. And that was just to win silver. So she was such a good golfer. It was 1938. She was they were doing like a charity golf event.
Mm-hmm.
And at the charity golf event, the organizers thought that it would be funny to put her in a pairing with a priest and then her future husband, George Zaharias. George Zaharias was a mountain of a man. He was a professional wrestler. He was a professional wrestling promoter. And they just basically fell in love on the course. And as that happened, they made a movie later on about her, like an older kind of black and white movie. The two characters that played George and Babe in the movie actually fell in love on the movie set and got married just like they did. George being the badass dude that he was.
What do they say? What is the fucking saying? Like, fiction mimics
reality?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, he was another great saying that just personifies George to a T. Is behind every great woman, there's a man that's there holding her purse. And that's what George did. After they got married, he decided that he had had a long enough wrestling career. He had lived in the spotlight for long enough to where he actually basically became like her assistant. He was her agent. He would travel around with her. He would make sure that she had everything that she needed at all of her different speaking events. of course, a lady in the 30s and 40s wasn't, excuse me, an athlete was looked at as someone who should probably stay in the kitchen as a woman.
Yeah, I think at this point, too, it was more, I don't want to say gimmick because that doesn't do it justice, but I think that's kind of what it was. It's like almost like a sideshow or gimmick type stuff, like, come one, come all, see, you know, how dominant. It wasn't something I don't think she was probably appreciated as much as us talking about this now. I think she was almost like looked at as almost, yeah, kind of like a gimmick or a sideshow.
Well, and so much of it too, just in her professional career, just outside of her professional career, she still excelled. She was a great softball player, a great baseball player.
She was a great noted as a, like, amazing at pool.
Yeah, she was a pool shark, and she even played football with the men. Like, that, she did everything, and everything that she did, she excelled at. And along with that, she actually
there was, are men that do this.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that in a way like there aren't men that do. What I'm saying is that, like, this is why this stuff gets lost. Like, talking about baddest bitches, like, she could show up to anything. She could show up on the court and beat you, on the basketball court. She could show up to the pool hall and beat you. She could show up on the golf course and beat you. She could outrun you. She could throw a javelin farther than you. She could jump higher. Like, she's everything.
She's throwing a baseball further than you every single time. Not to mention, as a professional golfer, she would actually, she was like an expert seamstress too. She made all of the clothes that she wore out on the tournament events.
Was there anything she did that she wasn't amazing? I'm not seeing anything that she didn't. I mean, of course, they're not going to list what she couldn't do, but I'm having a hard time. Like, you know, when they say, like, it'll be easier if I tell you the things I'm not good at. Like, this was her personified.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, what are you good at? Be like, it's easier for me to tell you the things that I'm not good at. It's going to be a shorter list.
Well, and if you think of the home of golf or the kind of birthplace of golf being like England, Scotland, everywhere over there, she was the first American woman to win the British Ladies Amateur. So she even went overseas and whooped ass over there.
To the country that invented golf. Pretty or much, was yeah. near the country that invented golf. That's like when people are so impressed, like, you know, when basketball was first introduced in the Olympics and the first time like America got beat. Or, you know, sports that we invented and then we start getting beat. Like, she was going over there and being like, oh, yeah, you guys invented this game. She's like, I reinvented this
game. Let me show you how to actually play it. Let me show you how to win this. So,
as a pro. That's what are you driving there, 175?
That's cute.
She's like, you want me to play with my 5-iron? I can play with my 5-iron this entire time if you want me to.
Yeah, I'll take 3 clubs out. You can carry the whole bag. Just give me a 9-iron, a wedge.
You want a spot? How many holes you want me to spot you?
You have to think too, George, like every single time they probably eventually just got tired of getting beat and everything. So he's like, hey, you want to wrestle? Like, that's the only thing that I'm going to have on you. And even then he's like, God, she's good at everything. I shouldn't try to wrestle her. She's going to get me in a drop toe hold. I'm fucked at that point.
We're going to eliminate some moves that I know she's going to fucking catch me in.
So she finally became a pro again in 1948, and this was kind of in the beginnings of the LPGA being an actual organization that she helped found in order to bring all of the greatest women all around the world to come back and play.
In 48, like you're saying, the only reason, because she attempted to qualify for the U.S. Open, and her application was rejected by the USGA, they stated that the event was only intended to be open to men only. You know what I hear when I... You know what I read when I hear that? Is that they were fucking scared that this chick was going to dust the field. And they were going to have to fucking award a woman to the men's only league.
I don't think that they had different colored tips back then either. They probably didn't have different tee boxes for women or anything.
She's like playing that from the fucking blues, man.
Well, and you have to think too. Back in the day when golf was such a boys' league, there still are courses, not very many of them, that don't allow women to play, that are just men's only courses. Mm-hmm. I know that they're few and far between now, but imagine back in the 40s.
Yeah.
She was showing up to courses that she had never played before and still whooping that ass everywhere that she could go.
Husband's over there being like, I walked the course early this morning. You're going to want to hug that tree line. Other guys are fucking trying to put it out to the right and everything like that. He's like, you can drive the fucking water. Just put it over it.
Yeah, George is explaining the dog legs and everything
else. George is over there with the other caddy being like, $50 as my missus outdrives your guy. And he doesn't even take the money out of his wallet. He's just like, you can just take your money out now.
Yeah, he probably came with an empty wallet and just bet everything that he could because he just knew that Babe was going to whoop everybody's ass. 48, she won the U.S. Women's Open. And to say that that's a big feat is a big feat. It wasn't, though, because in 1953, she was diagnosed with colon cancer. So as a woman diagnosed with colon cancer, she just continued to fight. She continued to play. After she had the colon cancer surgery, she won her third Women's U.S. Open a year after having surgery for colon cancer. She just came back and continued to go and go and go. In 1954, she still won two more LPGA events. She died in 1956. Those were the last 2 years that she played, and she won 2 years, or she won two of them 2 years before she died. She died as the women's number one golfer in the world.
I hate to keep jumping around between her accomplishments here and everything, because that's amazing in itself. In 34, she pitched a total of four innings in three Major League spring training exhibition games. I understand it's spring training, but these are still the
professional athletes,
cream of the crop of Major League Baseball. March 20th, she gave up one walk and no hits in one inning for the Philadelphia Athletics against the Brooklyn Dodgers. She had a little bit rougher on the 22nd. She pitched the first inning for the Cardinals against the Red Sox. She gave up like three hits, I think. But then she ended up getting another guy to fly out to like a future Hall of Famer. And then on the 25th, she played for the New Orleans Pelicans. Weird. They then went back to that name for the basketball team and pitched two scoreless innings. And she hit and lined out in her only plate appearance. She got a fucking hit.
Yeah, just the whole entire thing. When you think about professional baseball now, you get scouting reports. You see these guys every single day. She's just walking in as a ringer, going out and getting loose on the mound, and then just letting fly against these professional baseball players. How is that even possible to think that this woman was that good? The only thing that stopped her was fucking colon cancer. And colon cancer didn't even stop her from being the woman's number one
golfer. It slowed her down a little bit for a bit before it finally took her, but she's named as the 10th greatest North American athlete of the 20th century by ESPN.
And I would even say that that's low. Just based on everything else that she did, she was the female athlete of the year six times.
She didn't weigh 126 pounds. She weighed 115 pounds, it says.
Well, I'm sure she fluctuated.
I'm sure it fluctuated and everything like that.
Especially after colon cancer surgery and all that. But she was named the World Golf Hall of Fame 1974, so they still recognized her accomplishments that far after she was gone. But still, like, that's to be in the World Golf Hall of Fame as a woman who helped create the LPGA, excuse me, just basically because it was almost like the men didn't want to play with her. Like, the men were very scared. And could you imagine teeing up in the box with some chick that just said that she went and pitched two scoreless innings against a professional baseball team?
There's a quote about her that a sports writer for ESPN said, and I mean, I can't think of anything that sums her up. She's been beyond all belief until you see her perform. Then you finally understand that you are looking at the most flawless section of muscle harmony, of complete mental and physical coordination the world of sports has ever seen.
Her golf swing, to watch her tee up, it's just so fluid and so just, it's a work of art to watch the way that she used to swing a golf club.
Jesus. Fellow Texan, the great golfer Byron Nelson, used to have a driver, Byron Nelson, signature golf driver, once said that he only knew of eight men who could outdrive her. And she said, it's not enough just to swing at the ball. You got to loosen your girdle and really let the ball have it.
Yeah, so she's out there talking shit to those guys, too. Just everything that she did, she just seemed to excel at. And I don't know. I mean, she had to have had just a super drive to be able to do it. But just the irrational confidence to be able to do everything so well and to know it wasn't a sideshow. She wasn't going out there, and it wasn't a gimmick that she was pitching against these dudes. These guys weren't about to get embarrassed on a baseball field.
No.
They were absolutely going to go out there and try to swing their hardest and just mash something over the fence, and they couldn't do it.
Well, then, and you hear about, like, athletes, if you're talking about a one-sport athlete, and they talk about strengths of their game, weaknesses of their game, like, short game is phenomenal, maybe needs a little work on, you know, hitting their greens off the drive and everything like that. You are talking about a person that, when you talk about their game, you don't stop at that. You go to another sport. In basketball, she was great from beyond the arc and everything. And then in baseball, it said she could throw a fairly good curveball.
Which, there's many a man, probably 99.9% of men don't understand the logistics and physics
and the muscle control and the mechanics of how to even do that.
Well, and even thinking about it, I mean, arguably the greatest basketball player of all time couldn't even play two sports. He was a garbage baseball player. He was batting 200 in the major leagues, which, again, still something that 99.999% of humans can't do. Deion Sanders, arguably the greatest defensive back in NFL history, crossed over, played a little baseball. Bo Jackson pretty much excelled at both sports, but you don't hear about dual sport athletes. This chick was so good at what she did that she won gold medals and then crossed over into golf and won championship after championship after championship. It just that she is a myth that was a real person that walked among the living.
I'm trying to see who else is ahead of her on this greatest North American athletes list.
The 20th century, I mean, it's probably got to be like Joe Namath, Michael Jordan, all people that played one sport.
That's what I'm saying.
She just is beyond belief. And to know that she only lived for so long, I think she was, what, 1911 to 1956, so she was 45 years old. She accomplished all this in take away your childhood, say she was 35 years of existence in like her prime. And she was doing all this in 35 years?
Well, it's okay. And like you were saying, you're talking about single sport athletes that are ranked, you know, ahead of her. Okay. Michael Jordan, Babe Ruth, Muhammad Ali, Jim Brown, Wayne Gretzky, Jesse Owens, Jim Thorpe, Willie Mays, Jack Nicklaus, and her. But at the same time, you want to, and of course, you can't do it now, but if you're going to talk about greatest athletes and make yourself a list, I want to see her. Okay, she's not a boxer, so Muhammad Ali's going to have her in boxing.
She'd probably still give him a run for his money.
Take her out with Muhammad Ali on a basketball court, play pool, baseball, anything like that. She hasn't beat none of these other athletes aside from maybe Jesse Owens, Jim Thorpe. No, Jim Thorpe was hockey. Jesse Owens was... Jim Thorpe was
football.
Was he?
Yeah.
Maybe I'm thinking of the Thorpedo. Who was that? The swimmer.
The Australian swimmer, Ian Thorpe.
Oh, that's right. Okay. But aside from, aside from Jesse Owens, track and field and everything like that, and other events, at the same time, put him into another situation that she excels at. Like, I'm not trying to bump this up because we're doing an International Women's Day. I'm just saying overall, if you had to talk about the greatest athletes, an athlete describes someone the way that list is. This should not just encompass single, you know, they should not rank this off the excellence in their single sport, but to say it's just like that quote says, a flawless combination of muscle, mental toughness, all that stuff is, she should be higher on this list. And there are legends behind her. How is she not more
well known?
Yeah,
dude. It's crazy, and maybe it's just the era.
That would be the ultimate compliment, man.
40s, 50s, yeah.
Someone tells you you're better than, you know, you're a regular Babe, you know, Babe Didrikson. That should be the epitome of an athlete.
The ultimate compliment. Something that really, like, makes me laugh just thinking about is, could you imagine her and Michael Jordan, like, hanging out during the day? Like, they go and play one-on-one. She gets smoked playing one-on-one. Mm-hmm. Then they go out and hit the links. All of a sudden, Babe just whoops his ass out playing 18. He gets angry about that. He's like, well, what else are you good at? She's like, yeah, I can throw a baseball pretty good. He's like, okay, perfect. I played Major League Baseball. Mm-hmm. Let's go. Goes, strikes him out 3-4 times. He finally gets pissed off. He's like, what else are you good at? She's like, I play pool pretty good. She's like, Jordan's like, okay, well, I'm a gambler, so how about we just continue to
up I'm a degenerate. States? What else you got? She's like, I got a list here. Let me just hand you my card. Yeah. And you just fucking pick out what you want me to beat you at.
He gets his confidence up playing basketball, and then she just assaults him in every other thing that they do for that whole rest of the day. I can't imagine being that good at so many different things and to be recognized. Like, it's one thing to say that you're a scratch golfer and you're pretty good at pool and you know how to throw a baseball. There's a lot of people that can do everything okay. Like, there's a lot of people that say jack of all trades, master of none. I'm willing to bet she was a master at a lot of different things.
Well, do you know what the actual saying of that is?
Mm-mm.
Okay, so the saying is that when you say the first part of the saying, it sounds derogatory.
Yeah.
Because they say a jack of all trades is better than a master of one. But the full saying is a jack of all trades is a master of, is it one?
None.
Okay. A jack of all trades is a master of none, but is always better than a master of one.
And that's that kind of personifies her to everything. Just to think about football back then, baseball back then.
We didn't even have to do her during International Women's Day. We could do one on greatest athletes that have ever existed. Yeah. And we're overall, she's got, I can't think of anybody overall that's going to be better than her. Sure, I can think of people that are going to beat her in each of these individual events, but there's no one person that's going to beat her in a majority of these events.
Well, when she got the nickname the Babe, I'm sure by the end of her life, Babe Ruth was like, fuck, this lady's better than me.
Yeah.
Thank God they named her after me.
No kidding.
If I had come second, I might have been called Mildred.
The only reason that she's probably not more well-known is because there's another more well-known Babe. If he was just Herman Ruth and never had Babe Ruth or anything like that, she would be Babe.
George Herman and Mildred. Yeah, those two don't go together. But both being the Babe, I'm sure he probably felt a little bit like being named Babe along with her after that. There was definitely a source of pride for him just because she did everything. I mean, I know that it sounds like we're just gushing over an incredible woman athlete, but she's kind of beyond belief. Like, I don't understand how it's possible to be that good at so many different things.
No, you don't have to. And it's, I don't even think it's gushing. It's just being in awe, like, of someone who excellence across so many different disciplines. It's almost not even shitting you, man. It's, until I look this up, this sounds fake, but it's not.
To have 3 Olympic medals, to have 48 career golf wins, to
but not in golf. No, your Olympic medals are not in golf.
Yeah, you're winning majors. You're winning championships. You're money winners on the tour. You even as a teenager, you won a semi-pro national championship on the basketball court. Like, just fucking everything. The thing that I don't understand and that I have such a hard time wrapping my mind around is you hear about team events in track and field. The fact that she just went out there by herself and beat an entire team of 20 women.
The reason you have a team is because it's like,
because you can't do everything.
Exactly. It's like gymnastics. You know, when you have like the American team in gymnastics, you have your specialist on the parallel bars. You have your specialist in the floor routine, the vault, all that kind of stuff. She was just like, hey, baby, is the rest of your team going to show up? She's like, I don't. Yeah, we're here. We're good.
It's me, the guy that warms me up. And the guy that brings me the water bottle, we're all here.
Yeah.
Like, are you? We don't have a team uniform. It's just whatever I wear that day is what we're going out
in. And I make it myself.
Yep. Yeah, and I seamed it all together myself. Mm-hmm. That's, I don't know, man. I she's just kind of beyond belief. Like, I have a easier time believing the Joan of Arc story than I do the Babe
Ruth
story.
Yes, 100%.
Just incredible, man. Just absolutely incredible.
Sainthood?
Yeah, she's definitely a saint. And I think
the patron saint of fucking athletics ass. Of patron, no shit.
Yeah, patron saint of bad bitches. And I mean, the only reason that she didn't get final billing on this is our final lady is she's a saint herself.
She's the patron saint of the South.
Yeah, and just a beautiful saint at that.
I was really excited for this last one until this because, I mean, we're going to talk about excellence and everything like that, but this is completely unrelated. This is an excellence of another variety. We're talking Dolly Parton.
Yeah, buddy.
And if you don't know who Dolly Parton is, you might as well just turn this thing off right now. Or you know what? No, don't turn it off. Keep listening. Regardless of, you know, Adam not even having the information for Dolly Parton, we're just going to be able to talk about her just because of how prevalent in so many different things she is. And man, we're talking tiers of not only just beloved figures in the world. And I can only think of a couple off the top of my head, people that everybody likes.
Yeah.
That no one can say a bad thing about. The only thing you could possibly say about Dolly Parton is people that are offended by just
common sense
and big boobs.
Yeah. Nobody's offended.
And big hair.
Yeah.
But Dolly Parton, the Saint of the South. Dolly was actually born, and Dolly has an amazing story. I mean, a lot of people know her from music, movies, things like that, but she's a true rags to riches, and then riches to, you know, doing great for everybody that she can. She was born January 19th in 1946. She's currently 77 years old. You wouldn't know it to look
There's
at her.
No way.
And she was born in a one-room cabin on the banks of the Little Pigeon River in Pittman Center, Tennessee. Later on, they moved to another one bedroom cabin in, I want to say it's called Locust Ridge, Tennessee, probably not too far. She truly comes from just being dirt poor. She was the fourth of 12 kids.
Oh my God.
Check this out. So her mother had 11 pregnancies in the course of 20 years. The last pregnancy, the 11th, was twins. Her mother had 12 kids by 35. I'm 37 and I have one. And the thought of thinking about 12 kids is just, it's enough to make me biologically have a vasectomy, make my body have a vasectomy without even going in for a medical procedure.
And back then, the idea of having more children was basically to have more people to tend the ranch or
that's
to tend
exactly
the farm.
What it was. So her father was an illiterate sharecropper. And a sharecropper is basically someone who gets a piece of land probably from somebody else, grows something on it, and then they pretty much give everything and get paid for it, and they can maybe keep some of their own. It's almost kind of like it's peasant class is what it really is, if we want to go back to that.
Better term for the feudal system, basically.
Exactly. And then later he became a tobacco farmer, but still just a small tobacco farm. She got her inspiration from her aunt, who I think knew how to play guitar, banjo, and stuff like that. Her mother, I think, was of Welsh descent at some point, and despite having to raise 12 kids, always did a great job of entertaining the kids, teaching them about, you know, what would the music in that region, bluegrass and that kind of stuff, Appalachian type stuff. Yep.
So a lot of people playing the washboard. The washboard wasn't
people,
just for...
A lot of people clicking on their heels and stuff like that.
A lot of spoon
banging
work.
Banging spoons together. She started performing as a child on local radio TV or local radio and local TV in East Tennessee. By 10 o'clock, by age 10, she had appeared on what was called at that point, the Cass Walker Show. I'm guessing that was probably also something local Tennessee on like public access
Variety
or something,
Hour
like, that.
Or something yep. like that.
And at age 13, she recorded what would be considered like her first kind of single called Puppy Love. And at that point, she also, when she was 13, she appeared at the Grand Ole Opry, where she actually met Johnny Cash. And Johnny gave her some advice about pursuing her dreams, staying with music and everything, saw her talent, and gave her just, you know, you get a compliment from Johnny Cash at that point, and that's enough to fuel you to go, you know, the rest of your life.
When she, just to try to draw somewhat of a comparison, for everything that Babe did athletically, that was just kind of, Dolly had it. She knew what she was going to do, and she used music in so many different ways. She played so many different instruments.
She had that shine.
Yeah, she played so many different instruments, but I'm sure you're going to get into it. We're talking about somebody who created a full-on play that was on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that she did, everything that she touched, she did it with grace, but also she did it with just so much fucking talent.
True Southern Belle.
Yeah.
Like the epitome of the Southern Belle. If you want to talk about that, you even look at her, you're like, she's from the South.
She definitely probably came up with Bless Your Heart. Mm-hmm. That had to have been her deal because she was just, she grew up around abject poverty and just people that weren't very smart. And to listen to her talk, you hear that Southern twang, but it's never, like, she never says something where you're like, wow, that didn't sound right.
She had said, you know, of course she loved her father and everything like that. She said that although he was illiterate, he was the smartest person in terms of like business and trying to make money that she knew. So she gets a lot of that business acumen from him, I believe. And then I believe she gets a lot of her talent as far as musically from the inspiration from her mother and from her aunt. She had the determination that at the day after graduating high school, she moves to Nashville. And her initial success was as a songwriter. And when people have talked to her, she considers herself first and foremost a songwriter. She doesn't consider herself as primarily a performer or anything like that, as a songwriter. And when we go through both what songs she's written, what's been covered, and just how many songs she's composed, it's fucking staggering. But you can definitely see why she considers herself a songwriter first and foremost. She wrote two top 10 hits early on. This was right out of high school. She wrote a song for Hank Williams Jr. early on. And in 67, this guy named Porter Wagner invites her for like a regular spot. He had a weekly kind of variety show, music show, things like that. And she came in to replace this woman that was really beloved as part of the Porter Wagner family, I guess, named Norma Jean. Have you heard that name before? Because I want to feel like Norma Jean has been in a song, or I want to say I've heard that name outside of this, Norma Jean.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds a lot like Billie Jean. Maybe that's kind of where it crosses over.
Maybe I'm getting those confused. But when she first came on, there was some drama because Norma Jean had left and people didn't like her. In fact, the first time she came out, she got booed off stage and people would shout, Norma, 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 while she was trying to perform. Eventually, with Porter Wagoner's support, people kind of started to come around. And together, he kind of helped cultivate her, you know, writing talents and things like that. I kind of see Porter Wagoner as the version of the Colonel for Elvis.
Yeah.
That's kind of how he's viewed in this story. And she had some minor single success. She had some success doing duets with Porter and everything. In 1973, that's when she gets her first big hit, and it's Jolene, 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 Jolene. And have you ever listened to the lyrics of Jolene?
Yeah, it's phenomenal. It's
about a woman she's talking to, trying not to steal her husband, begging this Jolene woman not to steal her husband because she's got everything that apparently she wants. But looking at Dolly, I'm like, what? How? And I realize it's just a song.
Yeah.
But, you know, most songwriters are playing from a place of experience or something, you know, insecurity or things like that. But
she didn't seem like she'd ever have a man be stolen from her.
If you look at a picture of her, and even now, beautiful, beautiful woman, man, looking through and learning about her and seeing the pictures of her, there's a picture of her in 77. She's flawless. I don't know, like, I think Marilyn Monroe is beautiful. I think Marilyn Monroe, not all done up and everything like that, is equally as beautiful.
Yeah.
But you look at Dolly and you're just like, she fucking blows Marilyn Monroe at this point completely out of the water.
Well, and she had just a scientifically impossible skinny waist. Like, when you talk about older, like back in the Victorian age when they would wear like bustles and you would see like the very skinny waist, but then you would see
the waist trainers and everything. It's even coming back in popularity now and everything.
But you would see that the hips just basically bloomed out. Mm-hmm. They were bustles back then. That wasn't actually the female body. Her body is just so, it's just not
tight.
Yeah, dude.
So tight.
She's got an ass on her and a skinny waist and her, sorry for the misogynism here.
Even before then, she was so self-aware and she was so smart in that what she knew about herself and how to market. I'm not sure. I think this is factual because I've heard it from several different sources, but when she would go in initially to business meetings and everything, she knew how to present herself. So of course she's shown cleavage and everything, but she would go into these like boardrooms or meetings and the attention would obviously be focused on her chest. And she would look at the executives, whoever she was talking to. And she's like, I'm going to give you 1 minute to look. And after that, we're going to get down to business and I'm going to make everyone here a lot of money. So she was very aware. She was very confident. She was just, self-awareness is something that I think is kind of it's a dying art and it's very rare to have that type of, and I think a lot of that did come from her humble, very humble beginnings. And
she just knew that she had so many weapons at her disposal that as soon as she started pulling them out of the quiver, she was going to attract every bit of attention she could.
Early on, I think part of a lot of the gripes about her early on with her singing is if you ever heard Dolly Parton sing, she sings in a very high voice.
Yeah.
It's very high pitched. And if you listen to other music at that time, it's very monotone and singing like this and my dog ran away and everything. So I think that I'm not, you know, a lot of people use the term ahead of her time and everything, but you listen to singers now. And that's just kind of a norm with a lot of people. Look at fucking even Nicki Minaj rapping and stuff like that. It's high pitched and everything. Mm-hmm. That's a popular thing now. And I think that kind of didn't help, but that I think kind of prevented a higher level success early on. It kind of prevented that. But here's something. Did you know that Dolly Parton wrote "I Will Always Love You"?
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. Part of you saying that she just felt like she was a songwriter at heart. So that's not to say just what she performed, because like you just said, she wrote "I Will Always Love You" for Whitney Houston.
Well, not for Whitney Houston.
Well, she wrote the song though.
Yes. Well, initially, so in 74, she writes "I Will Always Love You." Here's the other thing too. She wrote "Jolene" and "I Will Always Love You"
in the same recording, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Within the same like brainstorming recording session, everything.
She wrote Tina Turner's "There Will Always Be Music."
Mm-hmm.
She wrote "Circle of Love," which was performed by Jennifer Nettles. "Waltz Me to Heaven," which was performed by Waylon Jennings. We're talking about "The Stranger," that was Kenny Rogers' hit. "I'm in No Condition" for Hank Williams Jr. Kentucky Gambler, Merle Haggard, all these different, and Rainbow Land, Miley Cyrus, which is her goddaughter.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just to know that that kind of songwriting acumen was so great that she not only had to attach her name to things, but these songs that she wrote that were sang by...
That people don't even know that she wrote.
Yeah. She ghostwrote so many different hits.
I keep talking about her self-awareness, her confidence and everything. When she, before she released I Will Always Love You, which did go number one when she released it on the country charts, Elvis wanted that song. At a point when she did not have that much fame, and I think they had drawn up the paperwork, she'd agreed to it, and then the night before, the Colonel tried to bone her over and was like, well, you know that if Elvis is going to sing this, he's going to get 50% of the royalties and the rights, the publicity, or not publicity rights, but what would you call it, publishing rights to the song. And she just looked at him and she's like, nah, I'll do it myself. And knowing that her song would be an Elvis Presley song.
Yeah.
That she said, no, I'm doing this myself then if you guys are going to try to hose me over this. She's like, I may have grown up fucking poor, but I'm not fucking stupid. And did that herself. Three of her singles hit number one on the country charts in 74, along with number one for a duet in that same year. And that's not even to, and you know, you named off a whole bunch of the songs that she not only wrote for these people, but that are huge, that were huge hits for these people too.
Yeah, we're talking about Merle Haggard, Waylon Jennings, the cream of the crop of Tennessee royalty, basically, mm-hmm. country royalty.
Coming out of Nashville, yeah, the epicenter for country music.
And that was just kind of what she did. And that was separate from her own career. She could have slapped her name on any of those. But again, in an industry that did kind of seem like it was fueled by deeper voiced males, she was still providing them with the material that helped make them famous.
The ingredients.
Yeah.
To make this recipe pop. I'm going to move into her movies. I think a lot of people, you know, are aware that Dolly Parton has been in some movies. 9 to 5 was kind of her big breakout as far as movies. She also wrote the main theme song of that. And how she wrote that, she was on set clicking her acrylic nails on the desk, and the beat came to her for 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5. And if anyone has not heard that song, if you've seen Deadpool 2,
yeah.
Remember during the very beginning opening uh-huh. scene? Yeah, that's Dolly right there singing that.
And that was what was adapted into her screenplay. She was a playwright, even just another feather in her cap.
She won 2 Grammys off 9 to 5. One was for best like soundtrack. Not only did it win associated with the movie, it also won the Grammy for, I think, best country song that year. So, I mean, everything, you know, she had some early struggles, but at this point, she's the fucking kingmaker. Everything she's touching turns to gold. In 82, best title for a movie, Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. And that provided her second nomination for Golden Globe Best Actress. The first one she got was back for 9 to 5. She did some other movies that were, you know, some of them took some losses. Hey, they're not all going to be first round picks.
No, The Rock doesn't make a hit every time he does it.
He's been on a slant.
Yeah.
As of late. But she stars in Steel Magnolias. Now, I associate Steel Magnolias with my mother because I think that that was required watching for women of a certain age range that maybe were born in the 60s and 70s.
Could be.
I think it was just I haven't seen it or seen parts of it in so long, but I do remember that being on TV in the background several times during my upbringing.
Well, and I think it was adapted from a book, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
So you probably grew up reading it, then you saw the movie adaption.
I don't think I ever read it.
Did we skip over Carl yet?
I'm going to get to Carl. Okay. I have it divided between early upbringing, music, movies, and then some miscellaneous stuff.
Dolly and Carl might be the adaption for just true love. Like, I'm not sure I believe in true love, but these two.
Carl knows what he has.
Yep.
And he knows that it's Dolly's show, and Carl's along for the ride, and he's perfectly happy being along for the ride.
Absolutely.
Which I would 100% love to. I might be more jealous of Carl than any other man on the planet.
Yeah, I'm more jealous of Carl than I am Stedman for Oprah.
That's what I was going to say. That's the exact fucking comparison I was going to make.
Same braid, baby.
Yep. So just a couple other miscellaneous movie things. She voiced Miss Frizzle's cousin on Magic School Bus.
Nuh-uh.
Yep.
Really?
So, yep. I can't, it was Eloise Frizzle or something like that, like her southern cousin or something. Of course, she played in a couple episodes of Hannah Montana with her goddaughter. Yeah. She was an aunt or something like that. I can't remember. Did you know that Dolly Parton also started a production company for movies?
Really?
Yeah. I can't remember the name, but they produced the Buffy the Vampire Slayer movie, the entire TV show,
and also
the Father of the Bride franchise.
I think I did some other see things. Something about the Father of the Bride, but that's crazy.
Yeah. And so, like, I'm saying, like, everything she does, she's just so fucking good at it.
She's just the Midas touch, man. Everything All right. she touches turns to gold.
We're going to move into music accolades, and I'm going to read through these, but the numbers here are just amazing. Over 100 million records sold worldwide. 100 million. 25 singles reaching number one on the Billboard country music chart, tied with only Reba. I'm Reba.
Yeah.
And I don't know how old Reba is, because Reba's still hot too.
She's still got it. Yep. She's she played a character in a show that we watch. What is it? It's Montana. It's something to do with Montana. I forgot what it is, but she plays a villain and she's a fantastic actress.
Oh, why wouldn't she be?
Yeah. She's just good at everything.
She's the villain you love to hate.
She is kind of a Dolly Light.
44 career top 10 country albums. 44.
Which, there's very successful people whose catalogs don't span that much, let alone number
You know how hard it would be to get one?
Yeah.
One country album?
Like, nowadays, not as much because anybody can do country, but she was against the heavy hitters.
Longevity, man. Like, just the It's not just about how good she is. It's about how long she's been at the top.
Uh-huh.
And doing it in a way where, again, like you said, you can't think of a bad thing.
No.
Unless you're so fucking conservative that a little bit of boob makes you uncomfortable.
Which, those were the people that raised her up in the beginning, too.
Yeah.
Like, she even had those people going.
She's like, again, she's a, you know, I don't want to make it seem sexist or anything like that or misogynist, but... Man, even as a woman, you got to appreciate the insane sex appeal that Dolly Parton has, even now.
Yeah. Yeah, for as much as we can gush about the hotness of Bradley Cooper or anything like that, I feel like women can do the same thing for Dolly. But that's the thing, was she was never like a sex symbol, because she always, like, for as big as her boobs were and everything, there was still a little bit of like a conservative, like ladylike nature to her.
Yeah.
She's always felt like a woman that you would never, like, choke.
You would beg, you would beg to respect. Take her home to mama.
Yeah, yeah,
you
exactly.
You would beg her to meet your mama. Guess how many songs she composed? You could throw out a number.
300.
Go up.
600.
Go up.
1,000.
Up.
Up? For 1,000? Like, 1,600.
Up.
All right, just...
3,000 songs. Over 3,000 songs composed. She won 11 Grammys out of 50 nominations. I know when you compare that and say percentages-wise, but 11 Grammys?
Dude, winning 20% of what you
When you're competing against all these new up... Like, that's the thing, too, is how many times has a Grammy been won by a first-year artist that had a huge hit or something like that? So not only are you competing with all that, like, newness and, like, the buzz and everything...
She's smoking out every flash in the pan that happens.
She was the she was a 1999, crazy how long this took, 1999 Country Music Hall of Fame inductee. Not only was she popular in country music, she was a 2022 nominee and eventually inductee into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. She got the nomination for it, and she declined it, first thinking, she's like, I don't think I belong in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I don't consider myself. And then they explained to her, like, look at all of these other people that are in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame just for their contribution to music in itself. So she eventually was just like, okay, yeah, that makes sense. Okay, I'll be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as well.
The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is almost like, it's kind of an antiquated name because they allow so many different people and so many different artists in now. I think part of the reason why it took them so long to put her into the Country Music Hall of Fame, though, is it's like, eventually they're just like, when are you going to stop? Like,
yeah,
we can't.
She's still going with some stuff.
Yeah, we can't continue.
She just came out with a rock album.
Well, and her and Miley do stuff together still.
Yeah.
Which is, it's just a match made in heaven.
And then kind of actually going back a little bit. So in 2005, she received the National Medal of Arts, which is the highest award presented by the government for contribution to the arts. just the arts in general. During her lifetime, she was offered so many times for Playboy, and being the good girl that she is, she only posed on the cover dressed up in the traditional bunny outfit.
That's why, man. That's why you can't look at her as like just the overarching sex symbol.
I'll give the people what they want, but I'm not going to give them everything they want.
That's not what the people wanted. It was a taste of what the people wanted.
That's what I'm saying. She knew where to go to protect herself.
Which makes it so much more desirable.
Oh, yeah. Forbidden fruit.
Yeah, and she really is. Still at 77.
So let's talk about Carl Dean. They've been married since May of 66. I think they just celebrated, it would have been in 16 that they celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, in 16. No, 2000. No, yeah. 2016, they renewed their vows. Carl, they met in a laundromat. I'm not sure how that went. I don't know if he saw her take a bra or he accidentally opened the dryer and was like, someone else's clothes are in here. And he started to remove them and saw that. And he's like, I got to find out whose clothes
he's fucking Cinderella'd her with a bra. Mm-hmm. He was looking for the breasts that match the bra.
And the thing about Carl, I think they say nobody for the longest time knew that she was ever married because no one ever saw Carl. And he was completely content to, he knew it was the Dolly Show. He was completely content. He had his own thing. He owned an asphalt company in Tennessee. He still runs it to this day. I don't know if he runs it, but he still owns it to this day. Yeah,
he's just a blue collar king.
He only, I think, came to one of her live performances. And it wasn't that, you know, some people said like, well, he's not supportive of you or anything like that. And she's like, no, he's very romantic. He writes me poems and everything like that. It's just that he knows that this is my thing and he doesn't want to take any spotlight off it or be a draw of attention or anything like that. So he lets me do that.
Yeah. You see nowadays, just again, sports brain, Giselle kind of has her own thing with Tom. Mm-hmm. Brittany Mahomes kind of has her own thing where she takes.
I don't want to talk about
that. That's why I'm bringing them up, because you don't like it. And I feel like that's a very kind of thing that happens where when you get a mate that tries to share some of that spotlight, it almost diminishes the spotlight on the person who deserves it the most. Mm-hmm. Carl knew that that wasn't his position. Carl was more than happy to stand in the background and let Dolly do whatever she wanted to, let her be a fucking amusement park tycoon. Well, he had his asphalt business. He knew what made him happy, and he did that. And part of doing that,
he didn't was also need that sure. other shit to make him happy. He had her,
yeah,
and that's what made him happy.
Well, and then he also had his interests. I'm sure, yeah. Probably owning an asphalt company for that long, probably really enjoyed it.
And the other thing too is, at any point, he could have just stopped doing whatever the fuck he was doing,
yeah,
and just been a kept man the entire life. He's like, no, he's like, I'm going to keep working. I'm going to keep doing what I can. Everything like that. You do you. Talking about her philanthropy, we can talk about the Dolly as far as Dollywood goes. It's a theme park. She owns a water park and everything. It's in Tennessee. Every year, it's either the top or one of the top attractions in all of Tennessee. But
it's her Pigeon Forge or something like that, isn't it?
Yeah, something like that. Her philanthropy is insane. So part of her Dollywood Foundation is this thing called the Imagination Library. And
this, I don't even know.
The numbers are fucking staggering.
Yeah.
So currently,
It's in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee.
Pigeon Forge. Yeah, we make metal pigeons. 1,600 local communities participate in the Imagination Library, or supported by it, and have provided each month 850,000 children with books
a month.
It all reverts back to the struggles of her childhood and the struggle of her father of not being literate, is that she took it upon herself that she saw something that impacted her life and decided, I'm going to do what I can to make sure that people have it better than I did. And then I'm going to help. And it's not just in United States. She's not just interested in that. It's across the United States, Canada, the UK, Australia, and Ireland that she does this kind of stuff.
I think I saw something where to date they've donated like 170 million books.
Yeah. So in 2008, she was honored by the Library of Congress and they accepted her 1 millionth. Oh, sorry, not 1 millionth. Bullshit. 100 millionth book. is in the Library of Congress. And these aren't just her providing these books. She personalizes and embosses these books with individual children's names. She talked about how a lot of these children don't even know her. They just know her as the book lady that provides them with books and stuff like that.
She's goddamn literary Santa Claus.
And just like, she's made medical donations to cancer hospitals. She's done wildlife. She does a lot of stuff from where she grew up and everything. She does like wildfire relief. It would take me too long to go through all of the dollar numbers and that of what she's donated and other stuff that she's done. It's just like, I think she's one of those rare circumstances. I think there's something to be said when someone grows up with money that has an impact where they don't have an appreciation or don't know, you know what they say, like money doesn't buy happiness and everything like that. Usually people that have money say money doesn't buy happiness. And I'm sure to some degree, people are human. So when they have more money, they just understand that maybe that's not the root of their problems and that they're unhappy for other reasons. But when you have someone like her that grew up just dirt poor, did you know how they paid the doctor that delivered her? A sack of, I think, oatmeal. That's what they were able to pay the doctor. And not only that, but she then established and kept a connection with that doctor throughout her life and when he was alive and made donations and things like that. I think there's even like a hospital wing or something named after that doctor that she funded.
I wouldn't be shocked. She was just that much of a selfless person. Mm-hmm. Thank God for that doctor.
But just even some kind of like miscellaneous stuff that's crazy that you wouldn't even think about. Remember Dolly the Sheep?
Yeah.
The first clone sheep. Uh-huh. That's named after Dolly Parton.
Really?
And the reason they named it after that is because the cell or the DNA, I don't know exactly how fucking cloning technology, but the part that they removed from the donor sheep or the first sheep for cloning was removed from its mammary gland. And so that's why they named it Dolly the Sheep.
Makes sense. Just before we get onto that, just for a couple seconds, is it crazy that we did that so long ago? Yet we don't hear as much about cloning. Is it because we flew too close to the sun and realized that maybe this wasn't the best idea?
I don't know. I don't know what ended up happening of that. It could have been to the point where, like, we're excited, we just cloned a sheep, and then, like, they stopped talking about it because 2 months later that sheep, like, died.
But still, like, we created something out of something else.
Yeah, a lot of that, I don't know if it has to do with us not wanting to meddle in that or there was some type of blowback on it, but that hasn't been the end of it because, like, you have currently overseas, I think in China primarily, you have them messing with gene editing. There's this thing called CRISPR. I think mm-hmm. we maybe yeah. talked about a little bit yep. where you can edit the genes within like a fetus or something like that. And it makes them immune to certain things like HIV and they're able to alter that. I don't know if there's been a long enough span of time between them doing that to know what the longstanding effects, like inadvertently, if you remove the part that is susceptible to HIV or certain diseases or, you know,
like a butterfly effect in human beings.
Yeah, but you don't know, like at the age, you know, of 18, inadvertently that actually, you know, snowballs into taking away immunity for something simple. So I don't really have the information on that. I just know that they named it because they took it out of the sheep's, what they would consider the boob.
Yeah, I love that. It's just whenever I hear anybody talk about cloning, it's always like, why is that? What happened to that?
Yeah.
Like, we just flew too close to the sun, maybe. And we're
maybe
like,
got scared.
Maybe we pull back on this a little bit.
Well, I think it has to do with something about playing God or some shit like that.
Like robots.
Not only is that named after her, there's apparently like a bridge called the Dolly Parton Bridge because it's got two huge arches. So it looks like a pair of boobs. They named the front armor of a certain tank that had a boob like curvature to it, like the Dolly tank. Nice. And then its predecessor was like the Dolly 2 tank or some shit like that. She, again, kind of going back to her self-awareness, she is completely aware and not shy about discussing, you know, she's not going to look like that without plastic surgery. She's fully aware of it, and she makes very light of it. A couple of her quotes that I love seeing were, it takes a lot of money to look this cheap.
Yeah.
When they were asking her again about how often she does plastic surgery, and she's like, I kind of just go off if I see something sagging, bagging, or dragging, I'll get it nipped, tucked, or sucked. And you can just like, and that's been a kind of a common theme throughout her entire career is that she's been able to be so eloquent and during interviews, questions, things like that. Because, I mean, people are going to ask her questions about current, you know, going on of the world and controversial subjects. She always has this grace about her that she's able to give the most, I don't want to say neutral, but the, like, the least controversial type answers, but make them in such a way that it's so charming that you're just like, I'm not even going to try to press this.
Well, it's kind of like, you don't expect like that such unabashed honesty about it. Mm-hmm. But then at the same time, when she does it so just casually, it takes all of the steam out of what you were about mm-hmm. to ask. And one thing that I even asked you when you said, I go, you got to figure out the tattoos. Because I've heard the myth for the longest time that the reason that she always wears long sleeves is because that she has full sleeve tattoos.
I've seen pictures of her with sleeves rolled up and I didn't see anything. And okay. I didn't find anything supporting that she has tattoos.
But, well, one of the things that I looked into after that, just because it kind of got the brain curious and going, is she has some sort of an issue with her skin where she'll have, like, abnormalities on her skin and then they'll turn purple. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't like seeing that. So she will actually get tattoos mm-hmm. put over the top of them so she doesn't have to see it.
Yeah, and you can tell that she probably is kind of a little bit subconscious about that because you never see Dolly tan.
No, she's, no, got, she's like, always very pale.
That it's alabaster Victorian skin and everything. Style. And yeah. Like if you made her hair dark, it'd probably be a lot more prominent, but she always has that white, big hair, that blonde hair and everything. So it's not as noticeable.
No,
I guess.
And just going along the same thing with the tattoos and just the completely disarming way that she answers things. I saw it was like a GQ article or something where she was asked about why she always wears long sleeves and mm-hmm. why she's, have more of a propensity to wear gloves now. Mm-hmm. And her answer was just, she doesn't like the way her elbows look. Like,
she doesn't like what?
She doesn't like the way her elbows look. So that's why she wears long sleeves. What's a follow-up question to that? Like, why do you not like the way your elbows look? Mm-hmm. No, some people just don't like the way that shit
looks.
She answers
that with that Southern charm that you're just like, okay.
Yeah. She doesn't.
Okay, you talk to me.
She thinks that her hands are aging. So she wears gloves more. It's like, okay, that's mm-hmm. the most rational answer that I've ever heard.
You don't beat around the bush about it. And then, I mean, she even has, like, even when she's trying to make light of situations, some of the stuff is very poignant. Like, they were asking her about her childhood growing up, looking like she did, like, in the Appalachians, everything like that. And she talked about, one of her quotes is, womanhood was a difficult thing trying to get a grip on those hills, unless you were a man. So, I mean, she's very just, like, very well-spoken. She's very eloquent. You can tell that even if she doesn't think about these things, she always seems to have the right thing to say.
Yeah.
And one of the craziest things I kind of saw at the end was, despite all of the musical talent and accolades and everything like that, she's unable to read sheet music. But what? She can play 10 instruments.
So she just plays it by ear, or?
I don't know. I think she just knows how she wants it to sound. And because she knows how to play these instruments, she's very self-deprecating. She's like, I don't play everything well or anything like that, but she's like, I can play it well enough to get by. So, I mean, if she's writing a song, she can probably go in front of someone and play on guitar and be like, I like it to sound like this and this, this, and let them kind of do the thing. But 10 instruments. And I mean, a lot of them are, what would you consider? There's a word for this. What would you consider a guitar-like instrument? There's a name for that entire like segment of like guitars, banjos.
Like a string.
Yeah, sometimes like a stringed instrument, but like guitars, banjos, which, you know, banjo is actually of an African descent. It's not American.
No, it wouldn't surprise me.
She can play piano. She can play a couple of those weird like harpsichords and like things like that.
Guitar.
Yeah, but I mean, think about that. Like, someone that has composed over 3,000 songs can't read sheet music. She's just doing it on pure sound and feel and talent.
Well, and if you think about it, when you said that she came up with a theme for 9 to 5 by clicking her nails, if you hear that and that's what sparks that kind of seed in your brain to mm-hmm. then start building out from that. If you can get the tempo to something like that and then you can match words to it, technically you don't really need the sheet music, but to not have that and to still be able to do that is just a talent that's unmatched.
Mm-hmm. It's natural talent. Like going back to Babe, sometimes it just all clicks. It all comes together. You feel it. You know how to do it despite not having any formal training or anything like that. It's just, you know, there are those people that find, I think everybody might have something that they're predispositioned or predisposed to be good at. But I think in very, very few circumstances does that person find their way to that.
It's so just like that the perfect storm.
Exactly. Too. Like that talent in most cases, you know, 90% of cases, that talent never gets to be nurtured, or they never find that that's something that they're talented at. You know, some people might be great writers, but they never take opportunity to sit down and put pen to paper. Some people might be great songwriters, but they never, you know, they're not interested in it or something like that. And so I think with her, it's just this weird, perfect storm of musical talent, knowing herself, you know, being able to just always come across with the right answer, being, you know, universally worldwide, like, you know, beloved and everything. And that's, you know, you put her up there again, can't think of anything. I was searching through information, be like, there's gotta be a catch. Like, where's the, you know, where's the poo in this situation? And you can't find anything. I mean, I'm sure she's had situations where she's had a bad day and she slipped up and said something, but I mean, as far as like someone that needs to be made a saint, this, yeah, you know, right here.
To have so few of those bad days that every human being happens to know that you've been doing it for so long that none of them are like markable things.
Mm-hmm.
That's just, it just proves that she's such a, just a humanitarian first and foremost. The fact that she cares about other people, her charity work and everything else that she does, as weird as it is, with as much charity work as she has done and still continues to do, it still somehow plays second fiddle to all of her musical talents and every other talent that she has.
And I think when it comes down to it, I think there was something about when her father was on his deathbed, he had told her, he's like, the library, Dollywood Library or whatever it's called. What the fuck did I call it or write it down as? The Imagination Library. Her father told, as you know, on his deathbed or when he was kind of nearing that stage of life, he's like, I think this is the greatest thing you've ever done, despite all of that. And I think that that probably means more to her because of that than anything else that she's done.
Yeah, I think a man who couldn't read, to see the value in that is just...
To see his daughter have so much success, but then bring that back to doing something that directly impacted his life and then her life, you know, of course, by being her father, you know, she could have stopped at any point. She could have stopped with the musical success and everything like that, but to have somebody that is willing to then, you know, take that money and actually, you know, put her money where her mouth is and actually do something that contributes so much to the world to help children. And that's not, it's just not something where she's like, oh, you know, I'm doing this to help them. She's doing something that she knows is going to set up people for success or, you know, a betterment of their life for the rest of their life.
She's so much of a, she's just kind of everybody's champion too. Like, yeah. She's never run into a situation. I mean, I don't know, not being a gay man, but I assume she's probably pretty much a gay icon.
She is. And that was another thing, is that she, at Dollywood, they have a, you know, I don't know if they called it like a gay, I don't know if it was like gay day or like something like that, but it was, she's very aware of the impact that she's had on the, you know, LGBTQT.
LGBTQIA plus.
Okay. That community, because
not the LGBTQIA.
If you go to like a drag show or anything like that, you're going to see, it's like a standard for three. It's Cher,
Elton John.
There's going to be another, I can't remember who the other one was, but then it's Dolly.
Yeah.
And she knows that she has that impact, and she's very open about her support of them.
AIDS research, all sorts of.
Yeah, her whole thing is that when she's ever presented with any type of like controversial question, she's just like, you know, I love everybody.
Yeah.
Like, what? Why not?
Which is the answer that everybody should give.
Yeah.
I would defy you to find a race, culture, or creed that doesn't fuck with Dolly, because I think that everybody...
They do. There was something about... I don't know if it's Gandhi or Nelson Mandela, but they were saying something that at some point he was saying when he was, which one was in jail, Mandela or Gandhi?
Mandela.
It was Mandela then. That when they were in...
Oh, I think I've heard this before. Yes, yeah.
When he was in jail or in prison or whatever, that they would allow them at certain points to request music. And weirdly enough, a lot of the requests, not just from him, but for other people, was for Dolly Parton music. Fuck, and it's, yeah, because it's just very positive.
Yeah.
And that just goes to show you the worldwide impact and popularity that she has, that, you know, she's putting so much good into the world, whether it be through her charitable contributions or just through her music and just the way that she is, that, yeah, I mean, I'm glad we ended this with her, but that's not to take away from everybody else we discussed here. And again, there's so many other, you know, women that deserve to be celebrated.
This is just our first International Women's Day.
Yeah, we're planning on doing this for a while.
Plenty more to come.
But yeah, I mean, other than that, I feel like that's a great point to leave off on.
Yeah, it's topics where it's so easy to gush about somebody just make this so much more fun. You know, we talk about a lot of doom and gloom, but to talk about the women that we did today and just
to not have to try to struggle at the end of the podcast, yeah, when we're just sitting here trying to fill a void of like negativity and just fucking bad feelings about like find the silver lining in this, there's not a fucking silver lining in a lot of situations, but this whole thing has been nothing but silver linings.
Yeah, this has all just been good into the world. Yep. In multiple facets of the world, this has just been good.
People that have been inspirations, people that changed the course of history, not only for certain countries, but for, you know, the world in general, people that have been inspirations and people that now still continue to do good in the world.
Yeah, and every year, that's the best part about it, is every year there's going to be another woman that contributes something that we can see. Just going over multiple topics, there were so many women that have been champions recently that we see in society that hopefully in 50 years will be talked about in the same breath as some of these women, if not already.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just going to keep coming. Women's Month is a great thing for, I think, everybody to just kind of take a step back and see. And I hope that it just only continues to bring light on more and more good.
All right, guys. Well, thanks for joining us again on this one. I hope you guys got something out of this. You enjoyed this episode, and we'll catch you next time.
Peace.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us for another episode. If you like what you heard, hit that subscribe and like button. Follow us. If you didn't like what you heard, still hit that anyway, because we'll probably cover something in the future that you do like. Please follow us on our social media. Adam, hit him with it.
Our Instagram is Historically High Pod, Historically High POD, and we are on Twitter at Historically High, that's Historically HI.
All right. And if you guys want to send in any feedback, suggestions, hit us up on those two, or you can even do it on Gmail. It's historicallyhighpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again.
Peace.